You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, April 8th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Josh Horton will join us. He is the policy director and senior advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders, who has just finished announcing that he is suspending his campaign. Also on the program, Trump launches an inspector general massacre. The election travesty in Wisconsin won't bring us results for a week. The Paycheck Protection Act already insufficient. And a Trump crony, Governor Greg Abbott of Texas, treats nursing home COVID victims with hydroxychloroquine without their permission. And after a French report that they have ceased using it because it causes cardiac arrest. Meanwhile, Richard Burr's in jail as more stock trading based on Intel reports revealed. Target delivery workers walk out. Federal court led by Trump appointees okays a temporary abortion ban in Texas. And the right wing says it's fine, but 2,000 people died yesterday of COVID-19. I'm sorry, they say it's fake. 2,000 people died yesterday as Texas, Florida, and rural America are about to feel the worst of it. Prisons around the country erupt in with infections, and some frontline doctors are calling for a reassessment of the way that we are using ventilators. All this and more on today's program. Well, ladies and gentlemen, obviously we had some late breaking news today. And guys back in the studio, my understanding is that Josh is on the video Zoom. Okay. All right. I didn't realize I was looking for him on the other thing. He can do the video Zoom. So we will do that. Let's bring him on. He is Josh Horton, the policy director and senior advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders. And do we have him? Okay. And Josh, of course, also was one of the first producers we had on this program back when we were on radio. He is talking to us from Madison, Wisconsin. Josh, welcome to the show. It must be a sad day for you. I mean, of course, we have a horrible tragedy surrounding us right now in many respects. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it is it's obviously a sad day. It was the greatest. It's been the greatest job I've had. I think back to a couple of the key moments in the campaign where, you know, we did things that think of back when the show first started, that would seem just absolutely impossible, right? I mean, you know, we announced a $16.3 trillion Green New Deal, right? And, you know, even a couple of years ago, people would have said that campaign is over. That's a fringe campaign. That's impossible. And people had to react to it now, right? It became a mainstream position. I remember when Trump carried out the assassination of the Iranian general, right outside of Baghdad. Yeah, Soleimani. And I remember, other people sort of going up and clearing their throats and saying, this guy was bad, but, it's good and, X, Y, and Z. And I remember, having a conversation with Bernie that the morning after.
Oh, we're losing him. Go ahead.
An event. immediate, the moral
clarity. All right, sorry, Josh, we're losing you a little bit on the
Zoom. Significant. And, you know, I'm very thankful that, you know, it was one of these things where, as someone who did policy, you know, normally what you see happen is that the think tanks basically put together a whole bunch of white papers and the campaigns take them and then show in this campaign.
All right, Josh, we're losing you. Josh, can you hear me? Josh,
response, and you know he's top priority, making sure that we're passing the ball this response.
Josh, we're losing you. What I want you to do is call into the other system. Did we send you the other link? We're just going to have to do this via audio. I'm afraid because we're just having trouble.
Is this any better?
A little bit.
Okay, the conversation was getting too intense.
Yes, I guess you were melting the internet. All right. Well, I mean, okay. So, and I want to get to sort of some of the things I heard in his announcement and going forward in a moment. But you bring up the change in the conversation, and I often think of, you know, I think the early interviews that we did with Sanders in 2004, 2005, when you were producing the show with Janine and I. And I distinctly remember, you know, getting off or ending the conversation by saying, you know, and at that time, the idea that we were self-identifying as liberals in public was considered a radical idea.
Yes.
The idea that we were interviewing a self-identified independent socialist. I can't remember what the specific democratic socialist. I can't remember exactly how we would have brought him on at that time. Was, you know, people were like, what? And I remember saying, you know, we should be so lucky to have an entire Congress full of people like Bernie Sanders. At that time he was a House member. And yes, the conversation has moved dramatically, right? I mean, the idea that you could offer a Green New Deal, that you could say things like Henry Kissinger is not someone to be praised in public and say that on stage and this and that, I think it's hugely important for setting the terms of the conversation. And I agree that on some level that it you know, you need to change the terms of the conversation before you can put these things into action. But where are we on that accord? Like, you know, like how much material benefit. It is good that there was a lot of people who said I supported Sanders' policies, but I wanted to vote for the guy that I thought was going to win, et cetera, et cetera. But what does that mean in terms of actual material difference?
Well, I think what that meant, what it means in terms of actual material difference, is different today than it was in January, or what it would be had this pandemic not occurred, right? Because as recently as a few months ago, you saw Democratic opponents on stage talking about how, you know, Bernie's plan for Medicare for All would kick 150 million people off of their employer health insurance, you know, against their will. And I think at this particular moment, as unpredictable as it was at the time, that where people are actually talking about caring for the least among us, the people who are the most vulnerable. And I think what you're going to see is this conversation where, you know, something that would not have been discussed before, all of a sudden we have a problem where, you know, we can't, the problems with a privatized system, the problem with a privatized health system, with a privatized insurance system, with, you know, a completely disjointed economic system, you know, just in talking about the response, one of the things that's come up over and over again is there's no real coherent way in which to create a safety net short term, because our economy has been so fractured and has been set up as an institution in such unfair ways. So I actually think that it is of utmost importance now that when we talk about, well, maybe Medicare should be covering all these bills, or maybe people should be able to enroll in Medicare when they get kicked off their private, when they lose their jobs. All of a sudden, people don't have employer-sponsored healthcare anymore. And so I think, you know, had we not had that conversation up until now, I think the set of solutions or the options that would have seemed possible at this moment of crisis would have been much, much more narrow.
Yeah. I mean, I think the idea is that there's been, and I think we have this problem across the board, frankly, is that we don't on the left have the same apparatus to have answers at the ready for when these crises hit. And and because that doesn't pre-exist, it's, you know, the right can just, and the center can take these things off the shelf because they're just sitting there. And that's right. And now the capacity for those shelves exist, and there's some ideas that are sitting there.
Yeah, that, and in fact, what we've, you know, if you thinking about, you know, back to sort of Naomi Klein's theory of, you know, how the right wing will actually anticipate these crises, if not sort of prompt them themselves, if we think back to the Iraq war, you know, in order to pull those things off the shelf. And, you know, there is one, you know, if there is one thing that I can be proud of in this moment, it is that when we're talking about what needs to happen in terms of paying people their own salaries, in terms of cutting $2,000 checks monthly to people, in terms of making sure that they healthcare is a human right, you know, it's that old sort of saying how, you know, the old canard about how, right-wing politicians didn't favor marriage equality or didn't favor gay rights until someone in their family came out to them, right? And where they found, oh, someone actually is in need. Maybe I should actually support this policy. And, you know, what's scary about these times is I think that people, you know, everyone is affected, right? And so I think that now if people can get a sense, any sense of empathy, or sort of find a sense of empathy because of this crisis, I think, in some strange way, that's a silver lining.
Yeah. We had a caller yesterday who made the point that there's going to be millions of people who have never had experience with the unemployment insurance program, and they're going to begin to realize that this is not such a, it's not such a,
I think there's another thing to be talking about too, in terms of, the value of the public sector here, right? Because, you know, as we've been talking through solutions, and we've been talking about the unemployment insurance, as we've been talking about how to cover people through healthcare, whether it be, okay, do we try and encourage states to ramp up Medicaid coverage? What we're running into over and over again is this problem of, well, you have all these conservative Republican governors and legislators who are going to, you know, where the implementation of these things is going to be stymied in part by their political choices. And so, you know, it's also, I think, and I don't, you know, this wasn't, you know, it shouldn't have happened this way, but I think that we're seeing, you know, the flaw, you know, of the sort of the conservative federalist notion that, you know, states can, and Republican governors can sort of piece things together as they want. I've been stealing a medical analogy that the coronavirus pandemic is essentially a barium dye test throughout our entire social safety net, right? We're seeing every little choke point and flaw as this comes together.
What do you think, as you look back on the campaign, are there things that you think that the campaign should have done differently at times? Well, I mean, what happened? I mean, 2 months ago, it looked like, you know, you had people on MSNBC saying like, yeah, I think this could work.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'll do that tomorrow. I don't know if I'm going to do that today. Okay. I'm proud of the job that Bernie and Faz and others did. I think that I think that it shows, you know, the establishment still has a lot of power, and I don't think anybody was in doubt of that. I don't think anybody sort of expected it to come out in such a concentrated force as it did, but it did. I'm skeptical of a lot of the second guessing that we've seen in some of the publications recently, because I just don't think that I think that a lot of people want to talk about what they think happened wrong who weren't really involved in the campaign. And so, you know, I would just ask people to for at least a day or two, look at the positives and I'm certainly thankful for what we've accomplished.
So in the speech and then were the comments he just gave in announcing that he was suspending the campaign, there was a couple of things that stood out for me. One, he said, You said Joe Biden was a good guy. Was that an endorsement?
I think, you know, the thing you know about Bernie Sanders is there's no implication or subtlety. So I think when he said Joe Biden is a good guy, he meant that Joe Biden is a good guy.
Okay.
And when he wants to talk about Joe Biden's campaign, you will know that he's talking about Joe Biden's campaign.
Okay. So there was no explicit endorsement given, which is not, you know, we didn't hear one from Elizabeth Warren. I think she also said he was a good guy.
I think today Bernie wanted to talk to his supporters and to us as staff about what happened with the campaign and the next steps. And I think, you know, how we go about what he sees as the next steps or next steps. I think today's a day for the supporters.
I also noticed Dave Weigel tweeted out that Sanders had not garnered 25% of the delegates at this point, which would not give him the leverage in regards with rules committees. And then I noticed that that Sanders said he's going to stay on the ballot in these states to continue to get delegates. Is that what the campaign is hoping to get to 25%?
Yeah, I think that there'll be time to talk about that. I will say that I think that there's no way that Bernie's voice is going to be absent in the conversation when it comes to the rules or when it comes to the future of the Democratic Party. You know, there are too many people, you know, I think that he has brought so many people into the Democratic Party, into the system of even engaging in presidential politics that, you know, I think we carry that responsibility. And I don't think his voice is going to go silent.
Has the campaign talked about, like, you know, you have all these resources in the form of, still, I imagine, tremendous amount of cash or a decent amount of cash and also an enormous email list and all that implies, the ability to raise money for other candidates, the ability to organize. I mean, the Sanders campaign has been noted in particularly this time around that much of its resources, completely unique to a political campaign, were deployed in helping organizing strikes, organizing labor movements, in a way that we haven't really seen before. And at one point, raising a couple million dollars for to deal with this, with the helping people during this pandemic. Do you have a sense of what those plans are going to be going forward?
Well, I have to give the sort of unsatisfying answer of saying that I can't break any news yet and get ahead of any
Click.
Conversations. that Bernie's going to make. You know, I will say that I don't think it's going to change that. You know, one of the, just sort of my own personal experience is every day in the campaign, you know, we would have email traffic about, okay, well, this local group is organizing about this issue. You know, can we support it? How do we support it? And, you know, it was something that was extraordinarily rewarding and continues to be, even after I made the announcements. I'm still getting emails saying, hey, can we get this tweet up to support these workers in this place that are looking for their employer to treat them fairly and give them time off because they're feeling sick and get the supplies they need. I think that Bernie has walked more picket lines than any other presidential candidate in history. And I think that his commitment to making sure that, you know, his theory of change has always been that in order to enact the things that he wants enacted as president, that it was necessarily important that these movements, that these labor unions, that these grassroots movements, that these immigration movements, that all these things got more powerful. The more powerful they got, the more likely it would be that that Bernie's agenda would be enacted. And I think that's still true. You know, I think that the benefit of Bernie's theory of power is that is still true now that he's no longer running. Right.
Right.
It is still the case that the more powerful these movements get, these grassroots movements, the more likely it is that Bernie's agenda will be carried out. So I don't think there's going to be any change in terms of making sure that these movements grow and do the work. Bernie's voice is always going to be there. Our voice is always going to be a part of that. And you know, I think everything from endorsing local candidates to building advocacy across the country, I think, is important. And I think, frankly, that what we've seen in the last 2 years is, you know, grassroots advocacy has become more grassroots. And, you know, we had a lot of sort of traditional, what, you know, 10 years ago would have been grassroots organizations, you know, having split from establishment DC politics. And now I think that's continued in sort of, it was your old Sundance Film Festival analogy, right? It's that, you know, it's the, when the sort of the alternative becomes more mainstream, then another alternative breaks off. And I think that you're seeing, especially, I think Bernie was most inspired, or at least very inspired by some of the groups when he met, you know, kids who were like part of the Sunrise Movement, the immigration groups, these kids who were DACA recipients who were afraid their parents, they would come home and their parents would be deported. Kids from March for Our Lives, you know, there are the groups that are much closer to the pain than grassroots organizing has been in the last 10 years, right? And so I think that that Bernie's focus is going to be with those groups for a long time.
You mentioned, you know, getting a tweet up to support, you know, an action that's happening around the country. What's going to happen to the staff? I mean, it's been suggested that that if Bernie's going to continue on with these organizations, that they're that the campaign may mutate into something that is staffed. Obviously, a lot of people have lost their jobs, and there's not a lot of opportunities for people out there. Have you guys given any consideration to what's going to happen with the apparatus that you've built?
Well, thankfully, Michael Bloomberg has committed to paying us throughout the November election, so we feel very comfortable that we'll be able to continue our work on his dime. Those are announcements that'll come from Bernie in the coming days. I know that there's so many on the staff that want to keep the state being involved, and it's really hard right now to be a field organizer, right? And so I think part of it is, you know, not just thinking about what happens next, is how what happens next happens, right? Because there's just not a model for what's going on right now.
Right. All right. Well, Josh, you know, I wish we were having this conversation about different things at this stage. I guess, you know, maybe over the next week or two, we get a better sense of, you know, what the next steps are. We can reconvene. But from my perspective, I just want to, you know, thank you and the campaign and Bernie Sanders, the conversations that we can have on the show now that where I find myself, there are people who are, you know, have articulated ideas to the, I guess, to the left of what I'm presenting is something that was a dream 10, 12 years ago, even, you know, probably 7 years ago, frankly, 8 years ago, 10 years ago. So, I think, you know, Bernie has brought into the mainstream a lot of ideas that were completely fringe, maybe in some respects didn't even exist, and has inspired people who I think, you know, at the very least, my kids are going to be, you know, voting for. And that's really, in many respects, you know, why I'm here. But thank you, Josh. You want to add?
Yeah. And if I was going to say, to say one thing to folks, you know, cause I'm sort of struggling with this myself, cause we're all stuck at home and thinking about, you know, it's very easy right now to, obsessively run through counterfactual scenarios in our head, about, what could have been, you know, whether Bernie made the right choice or not. And I guess my advice, for the sake of everyone's sort of peace of mind and sanity, is to just today be thankful for, you know, what we're able to talk about now, like you said, what we accomplished. I think it's a lot. I think it's a lot to be thankful for. And I think people should, you know, and I am comforted by the fact that I, you know, Bernie was such a, was able, I found it so, it was so easy to work for Bernie, especially in the last month, because, you know, despite what was going on with the primary, you know, there's not really two Bernies. So his focus was so immediately on the people who were the most vulnerable people who were affected by the coronavirus pandemic. You know, I can't tell you the number of conversations we've been in where, you know, the exercise is to just keep thinking through, okay, you've lost your job, you have a kid, what bills do you have to pay? In what order do you have to pay them? How do you get food to people? I mean, he's been so laser focused on that experience for that, that people are having right now. It has been an easy, you know, it's helped me not think about myself and not to sort of wallow in our own sort of political situation, that he has really sort of helped show me that right now we have to think about what we can do for other people. And, you know, I think if people want to sort of honor what we've done, it's to do that, is to think about how you can help other people today.
Josh Horton, Policy Director, Senior Advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam.
All right, bye, Josh.
Bye-bye.
Michael, we bring Michael Brooks on. So let's talk a little bit about this. We're Nomi is going to join us in the later in the program. We'll have Jamie. We'll hop on. I don't know if we can handle all the Zoom. I also want to find out what Josh did.
All the Zoom.
I want to find out what Josh did when he changed something and it all of a sudden it worked. Because that we need some of that around here. But obviously, you know, it's not a huge surprise. And I know there's going to be some people who say, like, why didn't he do it before Wisconsin? People should remember that the vote yesterday, we all look at it outside of Wisconsin as a primary election. But as we spoke to John Nichols the other day, there were dozens, at least, if not more, mayoral elections, like general elections that were happening, and the Supreme Court one, which was the big one. Bernie Sanders could have said, don't come out and vote. And then, you know, the fate of that Supreme Court seat in Wisconsin would have definitely been sealed. And, you know, once the Republicans insisted upon having that election, he did, we should say beforehand, say that he thought that there should not be a an election on that day. The whole thing should be punted. But all right. So putting that aside, what's your first reactions, Michael?
I mean, the first reaction is obviously, I guess personally, I was pretty prepared for this. I thought this was clearly coming. I wanted to advocate that he continue in the race. I thought there was some real value, particularly in the first couple of weeks, the way he was mobilizing around Corona. Frankly, I think in the first couple of weeks after it dropped, I think in the last 2 weeks, I would have liked to have seen, and, you know, Josh asked us not to second guess, so I'll try not to do much of that. But I would have liked to seen some specific mobilization against the bailout. I think we talked about that. I think there was valid criticism there. And I think now, you know, I would, as somebody who supported this campaign very strongly and does believe in the grassroots aspect of it, might not have been electorally successful, but I do think there was something important to it. I do think I would like to be engaged with and curious about how they can keep organizers going and maybe really specifically morph into something institutional. The most, you know, obvious thing to me seems like some type of pressure around Medicare for All. But it's, you know, it's sad, it's disappointing. I know people are going through a hell of a lot right now. The only other thing I'd add to that is I do think that tragically and by necessity, there is also a lot more room in politics right now. You know, I was somebody who never sort of, you know, I think things like strikes and protests and, you know, labor organizing is obviously incredibly important, but you don't want to kind of, you know, write checks you can't cash. In the last couple of weeks, things that have been not really on the table before are becoming much more relevant to politics. People are going on strike. People are doing a lot. horribly because it's by necessity, because their physical lives are at risk working at an Amazon plant, as an example, or they can't pay their, you know, their rent. There's nothing to romanticize about just how awful the material conditions are, but real changes are happening in politics on even that sort of outside of electoral level. And I think that that should provide us some grounded optimism. I appreciate Bernie. I think he's done a hell of a lot, and I look forward to see them constructively continue.
Yeah. I mean, I think the point that stuck with me from that Josh made was that we, in the absence of his campaign, the idea of Medicare for all being this mainstream simply wouldn't be out there.
Right.
And so now you can have, you know, some op-ed writer on Forbes going like, maybe it looks like the obvious thing to do now. And, you know, so it's on one hand, you know, the idea of you know, moral victories being really that in a quarter will get you a phone call.
Yeah.
Right. In some respects, you know, the value of mainstreaming ideas and showing popular support for ideas becomes obviously far more important in moments like these, when, you know, opportunity knocks, as it were, or needs knock, however you want to frame that.
I think there's a balance to it, because I like the way you set that up. I mean, the groundwork is really important, and things are in play now that maybe weren't there before. But I have a problem with this, and Bernie does it all the time. I think it's a bit of a bedtime story to talk about, you know, the poll numbers changing on various policy issues when the battles aren't being won. And that does really concern me.
I agree. But I also think back to how many times that I've spoken to people who talk about particularly, you know, full on socialists and even, you know, communists that, I mean, you know, people to the left and, mm-hmm. and people, you know, and maybe not even necessarily on economic terms. But when they talk about there is a failure of imagination, that we don't have the capacity to imagine a society reoriented in a different way. And you know, one of the ways we could do that is we could send everybody to Denmark on a, you know, a summer tour or something to that effect. But
that's what the campaign should do now.
Right. But like, just like
just send sort of, everybody
the same
to
way
Denmark.
They do those things to Israel where the, where
exactly. Socialist birthright.
Exactly. And but the reason why so many of those conversations start out that way with we need to be able to imagine, and it's not we need to be able to fantasize. It really is just being able to and imagine, you know, it's one of those words that makes it sound a little bit frou-frou-y. I don't know. But it is we need a way of being able to envision something in the same way that I can think of, like, I can imagine this this pause being over, and I can imagine what I'll do. I'll go out to a restaurant. I'll go to a movie. You know, I'll take the kids right to the playground. We need to be able to imagine something like we're all on Medicare. I go to the doctor, and the doctor says, like, hi, come on in, and I leave, and there's no, like, where's the credit card? Or here are the 14 different things that you get to file. Or, you know, can I see your card? And I got to pull it up out of the, you know, like we need to be able to imagine that. And we
absolutely
need to be able to imagine the idea of like 14 million people are going to lose their job. Oh, this is going to be, this is going to be difficult. This is going to be difficult, but we have an apparatus that pre-exists that, yeah, we don't have to worry about health insurance for all these people. It's not even a topic of conversation. It's just like, okay, we have a mechanism in which we will pay employers to tell all these people to stay at home. That's already existing. You know, like we need to be able to imagine those things. And without,
I agree entirely.
I don't know if Sanders' campaign got us there. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't, but we're certainly a lot closer. And I think that is important in terms of like the wide understanding. And, you know, I am quite sure that back in 2016, running in the run up to the election, when we were talking about, you know, what happens after a Donald Trump, if he were to win, when we were having arguments with people who are like, you know, Donald Trump would not be a problem. I am quite sure that I anticipated something like this by saying after George Bush, we got Barack Obama, and the idea that we're going to do better than Barack Obama after Donald Trump. I mean, I remember exactly where I was. I've said this a million times after Bill Clinton won. And, you know, I was a comedian, and comedians were not that political at that time, but I was aware that Bill Clinton was the president, the chair of the DLC at the time. I was aware that it was a corporatist organization. And, you know, I remember sitting in the Cobb's Comedy Club with Mark Maron, watching everybody cheer at the results and just looking around going like, why is everybody so excited? Like, I get everybody saying, phew, no more Reagan, because everybody perceived Herbert Walker Bush as a second term of Reagan. And, you know, those lessons suggested to me that the left often does better under an insufficient center to the left presidency.
I think,
at least as defined in the context of our country, because there isn't this, the broadly speaking, the center to the left does not have this sense of being under attack all the time. And their response to it is just, I don't want to be attacked. And so the left has an advantage when the center left and the center is sort of sleeping, that they don't have when there is, you know, this sort of like grave threat to just whatever it is that the center left perceives. And that's what a Donald Trump is.
I think there's another paradoxical lesson to also draw from now too, where, you know, I'll have sort of pushback that might earn me some annoyance from both quarters here, both sides. But I think that it, sorry?
That would be halves.
Excuse me, both halves. I'm a little tired, Sam. We're in quarantine.
Tell me about it. You see the bags in my eyes?
I do. I didn't even want to say, but Jesus Christ, buddy.
Yeah.
I think that the nature of the Democratic Party changing, kind of going back to what you said, is another thing that's going to require some really honest assessment. That on one hand, of course, Sanders has chosen, has shown that there's a real constituency here, and he's put policy options on the table, and he's trained people, and there's movement building, and these other really, really important things. But, you know, the party as a whole, I don't perceive it as having in any way moved significantly to the left. And I think that that's something to be, you know, to be honest about and really assess. I think the bigger point you're making actually fits with that, because it's like, even in such extreme circumstances, there isn't this sort of ideological recalibration for a better option. Essentially, it's still the same. It is the kind of, like, I mean, it's, you know, first this tragedy, then as farce version of 2008. Can we just get out of the disaster in an even sort of, you know, heightened, and, you know, what an election between Trump and Biden is almost like a Habsburg, you know, election. I mean, this is really extreme and embarrassing to even contemplate this general election. I would also just add, I think as far as imagining possibilities, I do think it's very important to look at the strikes that are taking place right now, the labor actions. I'll keep reiterating that, because I think if some of this is some things that are happening just via necessity, and people feel ashamed and terrorized, they can't pay their rent, they can't figure out their unemployment. So they're already actually participating in some sense in strikes on some level, whether it be rent strikes or otherwise. If that starts to become kind of synchronized, then and this, I think, was the most important part of Occupy, was just the very, or one of the most important, was just the idea that people all of a sudden collectively said there was a major economic meltdown that came out of Wall Street. And this is not a personal failing of mine that I'm not in the workforce right now. Maybe it's a failure of Wall Street. Maybe it's a failure of policy. And I think right now you already see a much more aggressive expression of that in things like the Amazon strikes, that if people start to really realize that they're in this together, that this is not their fault and that the policy mechanisms have been totally insufficient to meet their needs, maybe there can be some more sort of aggressive imagining of action. And I think that that's actually a very big opportunity right now and something that, you know, again, I wouldn't have emphasized a couple months ago because we weren't there, but we are there now.
Right. I mean, I think that's the whole point of the value of Sanders' campaign is that those people are, I mean, I think for the most part, you know, we have target workers who are walking out today.
Yep.
Josh Horton's analogy of the sort of the barium that you put through, you drink, and it shows all the sort of flaws in the, I mean, I think to a certain extent, what's happening with the four people is that they're starting to realize like, hey, wait a second, I'm getting screwed here. Once, you know, it's one, like as the tide goes out, right, people start to realize, hey, I'm the first person not covered by water.
That's right.
You know, however that works, or I'm the first person who is grounded in this situation. And the Sanders campaign has provided some solutions to what they are realizing is their problem. And hopefully, and like I say, you know, there is no doubt in my mind that these movements are going to do better under a Biden presidency than a Trump presidency, because there are going to be, I mean, if you look at it as just sort of like a pyramid, there are going to be, you know, and just in terms of the personnel, just staffing the, you know, a Biden administration, which is massive, you're going to have different areas, you know, smaller places, maybe at first, maybe in some higher places, where there are going to be people who are more sympathetic to these movements and are going to provide for them resources. And maybe those resources come in the form of, legislation. Maybe they come in the form of regulation that are going to make organizing easier, that are going to empower people in different ways, and are going to basically push other issues off the table instead of like, hey, you shouldn't be allowing more mercury in the air, or hey, you know, like, why are you having these private slaughterhouses inspect their own meat, or, you know, hey, why are you trying to take away Medicaid from 10 million people? Instead of that, it's going to be these other questions that, you know, that won't be that, that will get more attention. And that's,
I want to put another way that's maybe more provocative. When I think about the dynamic of who you want, having national power at a time like this, the Democratic Party in the iteration of Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer is dead. It has no, I mean, it can still obviously come together to win a primary and potentially the presidency if a lot breaks the right way electorally. And by the way, I think we need to be clear. I think, yes, the volume and the torrent will be different, but I think under a Biden presidency, we'll be back to the aughts. You'll be fighting another Simpson-Bowles commission, Sam. We'll be fighting that. I have no doubt about that. But the relentlessness and the range of what's coming at people will obviously lessen. I think that's people need to be real about that.
In addition to that,
I want to also say that having a totally dead project as almost like a caretaker government. And in some way, you know, the more you look at Biden, it really starts to remind you of the Politburo in the Soviet Union before Gorbachev, when they just had a string of guys that were like just about to die just to keep the machinery going and protect people's narrow interests. That's really how I see it. So that is actually different than, let's be honest, a right-wing politics right now, which is actually much more aggressive, much more intelligent, has a plan for retaining power, is synchronized in a global governance structure. They're not all the same, but they're governing in ways that complement each other. They're thinking through different problems together. The populist right is infinitely more, and this is the thing that, you know, liberals, it's funny, you know, they need to get used to. The populist right is a hell of a lot smarter and more strategic and more understanding of power right now. So when you think about who's occupying the White House, I say this, you know, to people in my zone, think not only just of the kind of traditional arguments about the range of things coming at you and who is most vulnerable, which is important and what, Sam, you're emphasizing, but also literally like, are you fighting against something that is just a caretaker? It's going to do a lot of damage and it's going to be disgusting. I'm not going to, you know, sugarcoat that at all. But it's not, the Biden project is not new. It's the last breath of something right. that started in the 80s.
And
the
right-wing
populist project is beginning and could be locked in for decades.
Yes. And I would say that I think I would even go further and say that type of caretaker thing, like I can imagine if we were to have insight as to what was going on in that Politburos, there's a lot of jockeying. And in those situations, that is where there is opportunity. That is where, you know, something has to happen. And certainly on some level, what we see with the Trump administration is the complete lack of leadership at the top. It just means that, like, hey, I got an invite to a dinner with the president. Great. And I go in there, I say five words, and all of a sudden the whole policy for the country changes. And that's sort of, I'm not saying it's the exact same, there's an analogy, not quite in that sort of. So there is opportunity. I want to bring in Nomi in a second. We're going to blow out format today. It's just not happening. We'll figure out a way of doing this other stuff in a bit. But first, let me just read this from Skillshare, because the Majority Report today is made possible in part by Skillshare. And for the first 500 people, go to skl.sh/majorityreport7. You're going to get a free premium membership to Skillshare for 2 entire months. Skillshare is an online learning community that offers thousands of classes on most any topic you can imagine. All classes taught by experts in their field. They have classes on drawing. They have classes on painting. They have classes on video editing and photography, and video and photography editing, web design and web editing, running a small business, and a whole lot more. If they were smart, they would get one up for how to apply for one of those PPA loans. But apparently, well, I got stories on that too. But all these classes, they're less than an hour long. Every class is split up into bite-sized lessons. So it's easy to fit Skillshare into your week, even if you have a busy schedule. For me, my plan, tomorrow I will be off. I'm going to be looking at haircuts at home with Mila to see if maybe I can trust her to cut my hair. She was going to do the bread making for sourdough for beginners, but it's Passover starting tonight. So no bread for a week. I'm going to check out the speed reading. I've taken in the past, like how to make my iPhone take better pictures, et cetera, et cetera. So everyone can benefit from setting aside a little time to get creative. You may have some extra time these days. Skillshare has classes for every skill level. So whether you want to get better at something you already have a lot of experience with, or you want to explore something that's totally new to you, membership to Skillshare is less than 10 bucks a month. It gives you access to their entire library of classes. But the first 500 people, go to skl.sh/majorityreport7. are going to get a free membership for 2 whole months. I put the link underneath this video. If you're watching on YouTube, it's in the podcast description. Check it out. Can we bring Nomi in? Do you have her, Matt? Okay, there she is. Ladies and gentlemen, the host of the Nomi Key Show.
For old time's sake, let's do a little pronunciation struggling.
And No, McKee.
Yeah.
Well, I did do it. It is. Because I do like a muh, and I can't do it like unless I go Mickey Cons.
No, me, key.
No, money key.
No,
get the money.
No, me, key. Const, patreon.com, the No McKee show, and youtube.com, No McKee Const.
You speak another language?
Style note for yourself.
I'm from Massachusetts.
Next, Sam. Jesus Christ.
You speak Massachusetts is what you speak.
Yeah, exactly. Nomi, I imagine you, well, I know that you've heard the news. I imagine that you watched the speech. What, what are your thoughts?
So many thoughts. You know, I was just thinking about 2016 when Bernie, said that he was essentially going to suspend his campaign and release the delegates. He did it at the convention, to Hillary Clinton. And I was standing, it was kind of this crazy moment with surrogates around Bernie, packed room. And I was standing on a chair, live streaming it and taking pictures, and just tears were coming down my face as everybody else was in a very similar situation. And Dave Weigel happened to actually write about that later. So if you ever want to go back and look at that story, but I'm not in that situation right now. I'm actually not even emotional, which is strange. I'm a little bit frustrated, but I'm also thinking, I think we were prepared for this. I think people who may have thought that he had a path forward, frankly, I think could have been fooling yourself a little bit. I'm somebody who is an optimist and a true believer, but I also, you know, understand that he wasn't getting the press that he needed to get in this moment of COVID. And he wasn't, even though he had the right message and the right platform and the right organizing for this moment, the press is just not giving him a break. I mean, before COVID, and the electoral path moving forward is confusing. We don't know which primaries are going to happen. We don't know if there's going to be a convention. And it's heavily weighted to Biden now that everybody's sort of, you know, fallen in line for him. And even though half the states haven't voted, it was already an uphill battle. And I think this crisis has just made it even more impossible. And I guess my frustration in this is that I wish Bernie had really channeled FDR a little bit more. I wish he played politics a little bit more. I wish that this wasn't about the platform committee, because I was on the platform committee in 2016 and we fought. It was exhausting. We got, you know, political threats. It was nasty. And also really moving to see organizations show up and activists show up. But 2 days later, they ripped up that piece of paper. It's not like all these Democratic candidates are using that platform. It's not like Kamala Harris runs on the Democratic platform that we ran on. It's not like Hillary Clinton did. So I think that Bernie, you know, really could still use the leverage he has, but that would require a tremendous amount of political analysis and understanding how power works. And I don't know if that's something that Bernie inherently gets.
Yeah. I mean, I you know, we don't have a sense of what conversations happened between Biden and Bernie that led to this or where it's going in the future. And certainly I think the agenda is going to be focused on trying to build outside power. And I don't know how much of, you know, ultimately in the short term, how that translates. I mean, I agree with you. I think, you know, the only analogy I can make in terms of when you talk about FDR more, I mean, that's really just a messaging politics type of thing. And in some respects, the analogy that I make was, you know, I came up in the sort of the alt comedy world and there was a lot of what drove my generation of comedians
more as Cross, less Marin.
Right. Sorry. Well, as critiquing the, you know, sort of comedy and entertainment at the time was, you know, that's what drove a lot of that generation of comedians. And it opened up a lot of things, but you know, you could do a show where you want to completely like revamp, and maybe you've seen this sometimes in news too, where you have a format and really what needs to be changed is the content, not the format. But instead, it's like, instead of like us sitting at a desk and interviewing people, I'm going to be floating in an orb. And I'm going to be, you know, all the we're going to use 3D holograms.
Very Marianne of you.
You know what I think is the problem?
3D holograms. Let me just finish this analogy. Yeah. And instead, what it really should be is, no, just have a different, more interesting set of guests. And interview them and interview them sitting down. And you don't need an orb. You don't need 3D. Just having it more interesting in a different set of guests. And on some level, Sanders, how he presented the issue sets, I think made it a little bit harder. And I don't know if it would have made a difference, but it made it, I think, a little bit harder for some people to sort of like adopt. And it made it a little bit easier to make what he was saying more radical sounding than it actually was.
I think there's a dual problem that they had communication wise, and they also contradicted themselves in it, because on one hand, there's this insistence on using language that certainly by the time he was actually a front runner, you did really need to drop. Because the truth is, he's basically saying, like, look, I'm about to lead the Democratic Party. Obviously, I have major differences with these people. I've ran a different campaign. I have a different value set. But I am going to consolidate now because I'm not the outsider anymore. I just won Nevada by a landslide, and I'm about to try to get this nomination. So you can't keep talking the same rhetoric. You need to pivot hard. And I think the FDR stuff is also there. And I think there's a million different messaging areas that could have been improved to frankly, from the beginning, sit down and say in 2018, okay, our campaign is fundamentally about dealing with the structural issues of this society, and what just drove the midterms was non-ideological resistance people. How do we synthesize those messages? That, and then on the flip side, and this is where what always would, you know, what did frustrate me was like, okay, you can't let go of this revolution talk, but then on the other hand, this is like the teddy bear campaign that can't draw distinctions and can't go on attack in just a normal campaign sense. And obviously I mean that in the beginning with drawing distinctions with Warren. And I mean that from much earlier on, and it never happened with Biden. Cause I always thought this is a Sanders Biden race.
Totally.
I never bought any other dynamic. Those are the choices. That's where we're going. And so I think that they really, you know, that if you cut down the revolution rhetoric and increase just the traditional like oppo research and campaigning, that would be a lot more effective. And I, you know, and again,
Bernie's thing was in his entire the problem is, well, I don't know if that's the problem, but Bernie's entire political history has been about not negative campaigning.
But that's bullshit. I mean, I hear you, Sam, and I've heard that. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm disagreeing with the idea that he does a negative campaign. I mean, he had no problem drawing distinctions between himself and Hillary Clinton on stage and otherwise. Right. So it's a convenient excuse used when he doesn't want to confront things that he's uncomfortable with. And I love this man. I love this movement. I love this organization. I pretty much love everybody on the campaign with all of my heart, last campaign too, and this campaign. But the political sophistication of this campaign was crap compared to 2016, when everyone was just like flailing and didn't know what to do. But you had people who had run presidential campaigns before in 2016. And I'm not saying that the people on this campaign weren't good at what they did. There just wasn't enough. There wasn't some central guiding force. There wasn't, you know, there's no reason why some
they
of these
may not have also had the relationships with Sanders to make him do things that he didn't want to do.
Right. And it's true. That's fair. But at the end of the day, and I'm that's a really great out for a lot of people who might be in his inner circle. But the reality is, when you're a campaign manager, a general consultant, or whoever's leading your campaign, it is your job.
Yep.
It is your job to make sure that the message gets to the candidate and to, you know, make sure that all the rough edges are softened a little bit. That is your job. It's also your job to set up a political operation to make up for any discrepancies or problems that the candidate himself has, so that you don't lose the WFP, as much as I despair, have my own personal opinion about them. You know, the WFP, which is ridiculous that they didn't get their support. So you don't lose Raul Grijalva's support. So you're growing the tent, not It's ridiculous that he's the front runner, raised more money than anybody else, has the largest on the ground operation probably in presidential, you know, primary history, and yet he lost support. There's no excuse for that in 2020. And I'm sorry to already go into the analysis, but I really think that this was a combination of communications, as Michael says, communication strategy and political strategy. But I don't really think that the blame lands in Bernie Sanders' lap. I think it has to do with who's guiding the campaign.
I also just want to say real quick that negative, I would really sharply draw a distinction between negative and just campaigning and differentiating.
Right.
Because I understand, and I'm not suggesting, as much as I would have enjoyed it, to, you know, run an ad that eviscerates Warren or, you know, makes a joke about, you know, Biden being senile. I'm not talking about that. I'm saying very clearly and very early on, I mean, just he did it a couple of times with Biden, but spend 10 months talking about Social Security, Medicare, and being like, here's the real risk here. And again, I think, you know, in order to do that, you need to get rid of Warren early and so on. But I think not only is Nomiki right, I think that we can't even get into that frame that it's either like we're totally friendly, and unless we're speaking in broad generalities, or we're being like, you know, personal and negative. There's a major middle ground there where most campaigning takes place. And, you know, again, I'll just say, like, I've heard conversations and people who would have a position to know, and this frustrated me across the board very early on, of like every other campaign, including, you know, Warren, obviously, is shopping around like a negative piece.
Mm-hmm.
Not like a horrible, but just like a, hey, like, you know, what she was doing, you know, like a Bernie isn't competent or Bernie's whatever.
Right.
Everybody's doing that except for Bernie.
That's right.
And I don't hold that against other campaigns. That's what you're supposed to do. But it's magical thinking to think that you yourself, you know, don't also have to do that.
Also, if you want to take on the establishment, I mean, we have to remember here what's on the line. It's not just that you have millions of small dollar donations, people have dug into their pockets and knocked on doors. It's not just that you're representing probably the most meaningful movement in several generations, without a doubt, for progressives. It's not just that you're, you know, representing the lives of people. I mean, people who really are dying, right? I mean, literally at this moment, dying because they don't have access to healthcare, or drowning in student loan debt or other debts, or don't have job opportunities. We know the litany of issues. Bernie is the only option for them. So with that guilt, because I'm Greek and I like to throw out the guilt, you know, you have to keep in mind that it is you to defeat the establishment, that the neoliberal consortium that has suppressed this movement and working people for the last several decades in particular, it's going to require a level of sophistication and ballsiness that you are not comfortable doing. And that's what it means running for president. You know, some candidates don't like to appear on camera. Some don't like to ask questions. Some don't like to get dressed up or wear makeup or use talking points. But you know what? You got to suck it up, because if you want to win, if you want to win for all these people who are working for you, you got to actually do some of the stuff that makes you feel uncomfortable. And that is the duty of the team around him to say to him.
Okay. Let's bring Jamie on. She's out there. We're, like I say, we're breaking format today. We're going to get to some other stories and whatnot. While we're waiting for Jamie, I mean, I think that, you know, we have two sets of sort of analysis here, maybe three. One is sort of, you know, what this campaign could have done differently if there was something they could have done differently in the past. The other is sort of what the campaign accomplished in terms of this sort of the issue set that we all care about. And I guess maybe, you know, like broadly, like how both those things can be applied to the future. I'm not sure that the first, you know, bucket of stuff, when we look back on what they may or may not have done differently, is really applicable, because the next candidate who comes up, who comes into this situation in the primary, who's going to have these issue sets, are going to have a completely different sort of set of strengths and liabilities as a candidate.
Don't you think though, Sam, that there is a broad message here about it? To me, it's almost like the concept of keeping kosher in a certain way. And so it's not like, yes, there has to be, and I really think the Sanders campaign bringing in social movements and helping with labor organizing was so amazing and so positive and will help us for decades to come. But I also think that we need to clearly differentiate in some respects, like a labor action, a social movement, all profoundly important things, with the very simple concept that if you're running for president, there does need to be an element that just is highly, highly professionalized. And there might just be a broader comment that Nomiki, I think, is pointing to, just like, you know, that element of, like, make it really concrete. Jim Clyburn's never going to endorse Bernie Sanders.
Right.
But maybe with the right approach, he stays neutral. Maybe. And even if that's a 5%, and even if that's, and even if that's a 5% chance, we got to take it if we're going to play that game. I think that's the lesson for a candidate that's going to run the insurgency.
I mean, I think that a lot of what they ran on in terms of organizing and using their resources for other things, maybe in terms of the campaign, would be better spent on the campaign. I had a professor in college who, when I was thinking about going to law school, he's a conservative, this guy. And he said, look, don't go to Antioch. I think I was contemplating at the time. There, I don't think it exists anymore, but it was a lot less, it wasn't a classical legal education, let's put it that way. And he said, go learn how to do the basics. And in the most boring of law schools, so that you can go into court and win.
That's right.
And instead of like, great, you know, critical legal studies, that's great, you can write a nice book. But if you want to actually help your clients, go in, figure out how you win based upon the rules that exist. Then that's if right. you have extra time on your, you know, on weekends and nights, you can figure out how to change the system. Jamie, and I think that's the point you're trying to make, at least in the context of these political campaigns. Jamie, are you there?
Got to unmute.
Can't hear her.
She's got to unmute.
Hello?
You got to turn up your volume on your...
me?
Yeah.
Turn up a little bit?
Yeah, a little more.
Good.
I like your Antifada logo in the background. Did you do that on purpose or you just have that up?
Oh, no, that's my friends made me that for my birthday last year. It's a big old banner. So I hung it up on the wall and we're going to use it when we do more live shows.
All right. That's great. So what are your thoughts?
Oh, my God. I have so many thoughts about this. Ugh. Feeling a lot of feelings. I'll try to keep them not too shoehorny. I don't know. Or maybe you want my perspective as a member of the anti-capitalist left. I think a lot of the analysis that I've read of this election from folks like Eric Levitz was very it threw some cold water on the idea that a left populist challenger could win the Democratic nomination under the present conditions, right? Like, I'm sure that there are things that the Bernie Sanders campaign could have done better. I'm not party to all of the inside baseball, but I think there's a ton of evidence for the fact that it just wasn't possible with Trump as the incumbent. That seems like it was a big factor. And with the present social conditions, with working class institutions at an all-time low, for a lot of these people, the Democratic Party is the only game in town, and they see it, you know, fairly rationally as the last institution standing between them and white supremacist authoritarianism, especially for older voters of color. So that was a very, it was kind of disheartening, but also, you know, it was a realistic view of what's going on. I think if we want to win more going forward, we cannot neglect the importance of these working class institutions. Although I think we really need to be planning in terms of 30, 40 years out, because there are not a lot of signs that the older generation is going to change their behavior before they die, basically. Because a lot of the factors and a lot of the experiences that led voters to behave the way they do, they're not changing. Like, they're in the past. You can't go back in time and change the experience of older Black voters in the South growing up under white supremacy and seeing a whole generation of Black radicals get literally murdered for asking too much. It makes total sense that a lot of people wouldn't trust the white voters to vote for anyone to the left of Biden because it would mean that, you know, social democracy gets instead extended to people of color as well. And that's, it's hard to argue with that given the experiences and given that history.
Let me throw this, this question to everyone on the panel, that we've assembled today. If let's just take, let's just stipulate that, the idea of organizing versus, and maybe they aren't necessarily in conflict, but you have a limited amount of resources. The idea of organizing versus the sort of idea of like that Michael expressed in terms of Jim Clyburn, like, you know, but let's just call it the backslapping. All right. that when you're running a presidential campaign, that backslapping might be more important in this context where you get a couple of key voices, because like you say, Jamie, you know, African-Americans, they're, you know, a lot of those people have an experience and a relationship with the Democratic Party that may be different from a lot of other people because of history. But if Jim Clyburn does stay silent in South Carolina and Biden doesn't win by, you know, the amount that he did, maybe the thing is different. Let's just, you know, stipulate that. What about the idea of, in terms of policy sets, where, I mean, from my perspective, and I don't, you know, I know there are differing opinions here in terms of like the implications of Warren's plan to get to Medicare for all and Bernie's plan to get to Medicare for all. But now they are completely equal. They are both completely inoperative and dead. And it would have been it was also my opinion that they also were both inoperative and dead as outlined because of what the political realities are going to be one way or another. You could have a Democratic Senate and a Democratic House, but that Democratic Senate is still going to include Chris Coons. It's going to include Mark Kelly. If we get it, it's going to be Kristen Sinema. It's going to be Joe Manchin. It's going to be, you know, maybe Hickenlooper or whoever. And some of those people are going to run to the middle and say, like, I'm part of the Gang of Six and we're not going to do this. that's my theory anyways. But be that as it may, what of the idea that that type of rigidity in presenting policies, that, you know, doing a two-step legislative plan, which I think probably would have failed, versus a one-step legislative plan, which I also think would have probably failed in that context, that making that the center point of the debate was inhibited the ability for the left, broadly speaking, and Sanders, if you will, to win, because that, you know, like the strongest step forward that Sanders had was his lack of details on how we're going to pay for Medicare for all. And maybe there should have been even less details on it and less stridency about this must happen that was an inhibition on some level.
I think we need to just not mismatch. Like, I guess I think even that in a way is almost too specific, right? Like, I think the clear big picture problem of him not bringing over enough voters, there's all these different variables. I will push back. We don't have to get into it now, but I think we have to always remember that the African-American voter electorate is very diverse, definitely does not have a unitary interest or ideology like any other group. But I think the big thing he needed to do to flip people in his column that weren't in his column was to basically much more early and much more aggressively figure out a way to rework the electability argument in his favor. Now, could he have been a little bit softer on Medicare for all, and would that have helped? Maybe in certain contexts. But I think honestly, it was actually getting into that whole road and that whole distraction from Warren, which at the end of the day is like a fifth place finisher. She's not a, but just even those arguments in general.
But don't you think that when Biden said, Buttigieg and Biden said, I think, 170 million, yes. Now, listen, 170 well, million people are going to lose their private health insurance, that inhibited the electability argument?
Well, I think that, we don't know that because he hadn't been making, sorry.
Is it, Bernie should have had an answer for that. I mean, yeah, part Bernie, of this goes one, back to communications.
He should have had an answer, but also
who's prepping you?
He would have made, he had to have gone after Biden from out of the gate to even be on that playing field. Like, oh, the guy who's going to lie about my healthcare plan is the one who has a million unpopular policy proposals and whose son is going to drag us into a scandal. No thanks. Like, I'm not trying to evade your question, Sam. I just think it's much bigger. I don't think that there's one weird trick that would make Medicare for All, you know, have like an uncriticizable thing. I think if you want to fearmonger about it, you can do that. And I do think that at the end of the day, Bernie supports Medicare for All, and it's good he supported Medicare for All. Maybe there's other issues he should have tried to bring into the main, like Medicare for All. But
well,
I mean,
what if you said, let me put it this way. If Bernie had said, Medicare for All, we're not outlawing private insurance. We are simply talking about, that we're going to require, doctors to take a specific percentage of patients on Medicare for All. And then you, what you would get from the policy wonk who supports Pete Buttigieg is like, well, wait, that's an effective, outlawing of private insurance. He could have still said, but we're not outlawing private insurance.
I think the and problem then, with that, then they would say, what's the difference between our plans? Right. Bernie says he wants to do this big, bold thing. We're proposing the same thing. That sounds like Medicare for All that want it. That would have been, that wouldn't have worked particularly well either. But I just think the bigger picture thing is even just more crude and simplistic than that, which is just start out of the gate with Risky Joe, Risky Joe, mm-hmm. Risky Joe, and Irrelevant Liz. Like, and just start to set your lane up. I think the bigger picture thing.
I think there's two things here. Number one, the reason why they attacked Medicare for All, I mean, obviously they take health insurance money and it's a big issue that they're going to prevent from happening. But it's because it was the message of the Bernie campaign. So no matter what Bernie said, they were going to find a way to attack him, which really comes back, I mean, to your original question about his leadership, if he were the president with, you know, a Senate of mansions and cinemas, you know, this is what it means to be a leader. I mean, what Obama effectively in some cases did, which is strange because he doesn't really have this innate ability, is that he was able to use his political power to leverage against senators towards the end, especially when he wanted something accomplished. Not always. I mean, we know that, like, that he had a lot of gripes with the left in particular. I mean, Keith Ellison, he had a very public feud with, and that is part of the reason why he went after Keith Ellison so aggressively in those final days with Tom Perez. Could have gone a different way, but you know, that's leadership. And that really comes back to the politics here. The next left leader, whoever that left leader is that runs for president, that hopefully is as far to left as Bernie and maybe even more so, they have to have that political infrastructure so that they know how to build the coalitions, pressure leaders, pressure Senator Schumer, whoever the next Senate leader is, and to pressure Pelosi, whoever the next leader is in Congress. We have to understand this is not a game of like, oh, well, we have to be prepared because five Democratic senators might turn on us. Well, of course they are. You have to play a little Johnson here.
I know that. I guess my point is, though, and from what I'm hearing so far, and Jamie, you can weigh in on this too, is that one, there may be some agreement that having a more backslapping campaign for a lack of a shorthand is important, but there's no sense that that taking issues with that level of rigidity impact the electability argument. I personally believe that it might, that there are, that in fact does impact electability. Barack Obama won that election in 2008. And he and Hillary Clinton and John Edwards had the exact same healthcare program. Mm-hmm. The only difference is that Barack Obama said, we don't enforce a mandate. And we just make it a social security, we make it a tax. And that's what he said. It was basically the mandate that we got. And
but he didn't win on that.
Huh?
But he didn't, that wasn't something he ran on and went.
He didn't lose because of it.
Sure, but it wasn't his central campaign piece.
Bernie didn't lose because of single payer. Bernie, these are the things we're talking about are much bigger problems.
I'm not saying that he lost because of single payer.
Well, you just made the Obama analogy.
Well, I'm just telling you that a campaign is a series of things that you must do and a series of things that you don't want to get sidetracked on.
So I would just suggest that I think, Sam, I get what you're saying, but I think like if it's really clear from
I just asked the question, if you don't think that the issue set and the way that it's presented in any way, makes a difference.
I think there might have been some other issues, frankly, there are other issue sets that I would agree with politically, but might have posed, bigger problems, frankly, electorally. And I don't know if that would be like Medicare for all. I think in a general election, I think the immigration plan could run into some difficulty.
But in the primary, in terms of people's perception of electability,
I think people's perception of electability had nothing to do with had very little to do with Medicare for all.
Or frankly, any of his
issues. All the stuff we're talking about. And I think if it's very clear that it's these sort of more strategic and communications questions, and it doesn't require a dilution of policy, that's probably the direction we should go in, right?
Well, I mean, I agree in that respect, but I'm not clear that's the only exclusive thing. Go ahead, Jamie.
I thought he did a very good job explaining why Medicare for All is the only good way to get everybody insured for less money and to have medical care be free at the point of service. I was especially impressed by his performance at the Fox News town halls where he got those people on his side. Mm-hmm. Like most people who aren't wealthy understand on a very visceral level why we need to give everybody health care. And like even Trump echoed some of that rhetoric, and that's helped him win the primary the last time around. I think issues like immigration, I think we need to be careful. Because, certainly you should go to people where they are in terms of the rhetoric. I mostly agree with that. I thought it was good, actually, that Joe Rogan endorsed Bernie. And I thought some of the anger about that was misdirected. But you can't move an inch on policy. You can't be throwing people under the bus, especially when a lot of Bernie's success was due to getting Hispanic voters of all ages to vote for him. And now if you just look at the polls, it is true that things like healthcare and the economy are the most important to Hispanic voters. And immigration is, I think, like number three or something. I looked at some polls when I was arguing with some people on Twitter. But it's still very important. And we can't be triangulating and throwing any sector of the working class under the bus when we're trying to build a working class movement, of which this electoral victory is only one part, because then we haven't won shit. Like, what are we doing this for? Like, Democrats triangulate, and what was it? It was a managed fall. It didn't work, even for the very narrow winning elections purposes that they pitched it as.
I have to say that I don't think this had anything to do with his platform. I think it was just an excuse, no matter what he did, they were going to find a way to attack. There was a sweet spot, if you recall, probably after he won Nevada or with the first three states, when like, the biggest feminists in the Democratic Party after Warren dropped out, the biggest feminists of the party who had been, Bernie's nemesis, were suddenly warming up to Bernie because they couldn't they couldn't see themselves supporting Joe Biden. And you saw a lot of like the Netroots crowd and sort of like the left leaning.
The MSNBC, MSNBC younger hosts saying exactly. Like, yeah, Bernie's doable. That type of thing.
Exactly. And that was when Bernie sort of seized the moment and gone bolder. And he didn't. And so it didn't matter what his platform was, what little minor details. It was about how he responded to the electability argument, as Michael said, how he broadened his coalition, how he said, all right, I am the front runner now, and I am going to seize this moment and appeal to, you know, the more institutional Democrats. And frankly, laid out the argument that I never heard him say. I mean, I just heard him say young people across the country. It was the same talking points. But there is a real issue when the Democratic frontrunner, or now the presumed nominee, was only elected by the majority of voters over the age of 60 in states after South Carolina. That's not traditional in the Democratic Party. And that's actually existential, that 70% collectively of Democratic voters under the age of 50 supported one man, and it was Bernie Sanders. That's a real problem.
It's very hard, I think, to make broad assessments when you do have that sort of very weird and atypical sort of generational split that I haven't seen in my adult years, which are many. I can't point to a race where it's like Edwards had everybody over the age of 50 and Obama had everybody under the age of 50. Like, this didn't happen. Obama drove a lot of the youth vote. And part of the problem was that Bernie did not get enough of those people out, even though he was winning them all in terms of younger voters.
Can I make one more point on that? Just because I've seen this come up a lot. And, I think all of us have had experience in cable news and in the media space and the new media. You know, I've heard a lot of people blame cable news for this election. And we have to keep in mind is it's cable news is going to cable news. And they were going to go hard on Bernie. And Bernie definitely didn't get fair coverage. But we knew that going in. You knew the framework going in, picking arguments with, you know, cable news. I don't think that was the best strategy for Bernie. I think, you know, they are the ones setting the message for the voters that, you know, only watch cable news. And so moving forward, I've heard people say, oh, we need to create our version of MSNBC. That's not the future. The future is decentralized media. The future is more YouTube and Twitch. You know, if we want to replicate cable news, you know, and think that we're going to win over the 60 plus audience suddenly overnight, that's just not realistic. So we have to think about the
future. There's no way. It's incompatible.
It's incompatible.
There is no cable news future for this perspective. These things are almost diametrically opposed.
Right.
And they're dying. And they're literally, I don't mean to, existentially, we have to keep in mind.
Wow, Nomi.
Well, no, not COVID. But I mean, this is really important because I think we often look back at elections and hyper-react to the last election rather than thinking in 4 years, the demographics are going to be even more in our favor.
Right.
So how do we make up that difference and take the millennials who are going to be in their 40s and going to be prime voters and play out what happens with the demographics over 60, which are becoming smaller and smaller by the day.
Let me just say this one point, that it is also clear that Joe Biden has not gotten a fair shake on YouTube and Twitch.
Sam, I'm sure you'll work to correct that. I just want to say that I think that this is another criticism, actually, and I'll point to Mike Figueredo, who does the Humanist Report, which is a good YouTube show. You know, he had a thread, and I have not liked to make these complaints, frankly, because they sound really self-serving, but he did say, like, look, Matt Karp showed polls. Basically, it was like why Bernie can't do it in the Democratic Party and Trump can, and one dumb chart. And it basically showed like Democrats are way more trusting of mainstream media than Republicans are. Right. And I think that there's some truth in drawing that analogy. Now, whether or not you're moving to a better place than corporate media or a less place is obviously another conversation. But Mike Figueredo's point was, you know, Trump, every single major Republican leader cultivates, spends time with, and really amplifies their media base. They go on obscure as hell outlets. They recognize them. They give them energy. And, you know, Bernie, frankly, did not do nearly enough of that. I don't think AOC has appeared on any of those outlets since she's been elected. And again, it sounds self-serving So, you know, whatever, like take TMBS out of it or whatever. I don't care. Do Majority Report, do Nomiki, like more. But you, especially in the context of these other platforms dying and the reality that, like, even for this campaign, this independent media infrastructure mattered for Bernie even getting as far as he did. You better start thinking about seriously cultivating it and engaging it and spending a lot of time with it like Republicans do. It's in your own self-interest if you want to govern somewhat or run somewhat to the left.
Period. And building the pipeline, because, you know, we have to keep in mind here, and yes, I'm sure your audience knows this, that, okay, so I've spent a lot of time on conservative media. They build the pipeline. They find talent. They get behind them. They bolster them. I mean, look at Kayleigh McEnany, who I've known for like 7 years. You know, she's now the spokesperson for the White House. This is crazy. She started off, you know, just using a booker and writing blogs. And now she's, granted, you know, he takes it to another level. But on top of that, you know, we know where the algorithms are going. We know that right now we're all hurting a little bit under COVID, that people are watching MSNBC and CNN, and that it's weighted, that the algorithms are weighted towards them. So there's even more importance, you know, it's even more important that Bernie and AOC and other leaders don't take us for granted, because we are the ones that are going to make sure that base turns out. And I mean, it is a little self-serving in some ways, but
it's just the truth. It's just the truth. You need to look, if we, yeah. And Nomiki and I will refine our Chris Matthews impressions. Like, come on, AOC, be a guest on our show.
I got the Rachel Maddow.
Yeah. Look, we need more guests on YouTube, but seriously, like it is ridiculous that they don't see and don't act on the same need that the right frankly does. And it's a big problem.
There's definitely, I think, more liability. Go ahead, Jamie.
Don't you think that everybody who's watching alternative media is already going to go out and vote for Bernie though? Like,
no.
It seems to me,
I think everybody that's watching the right-wing media is going to vote for, have a likelihood of voting for Trump. But the point is cultivating it and amplifying power and building an alternative hegemonic base in media to the extent that's possible. Politicians need to be a part of that.
What they're saying is not that Bernie shouldn't come on our shows for the sake of Bernie, that Bernie should come on our shows for the sake of us that will ultimately get big enough to bring people, you know, like, so Bernie goes on Joe Rogan. And I mean, this is, you know, this was part of the criticism that I think, you know, that people missed, is that it is elevating Joe Rogan. Joe Rogan has a huge show, but now, I mean, look, Marc Maron had a huge show, WTF, all right, just to use this example, and not a political show. And he had Barack Obama on, and it didn't in any way, you know, it was not a political conversation in any way. But then Marc Maron is in the canon with, you know, with Terry What's-Her-Face, and it elevated Maron. It to have a political candidate go on Joe Rogan, it elevates Joe Rogan. I happen to think that it was a worthwhile thing to do, because you're out there, you're trying to reach other people. But the idea is that the politicians, the argument is, as I understand it, is the politicians need to be giving the independent media some of their cachet to build up that independent media, so that when you need a cavalry, we're there.
That's right.
And we are the cavalry, and that's what we're dealing with.
I will
with
also that. Say this. There is a double standard for the left and for us. Like, you don't hear the only person who, you know, would talk about how Congressman called into Rush Limbaugh to apologize for saying something that Limbaugh criticized. They've been doing this for decades. They would call in and literally, Rush, I just want to say, I'm sorry. I think I was wrong. And maybe you misinterpreted something, but I'm not saying you really misinterpreted what I said. I just think that I was wrong. And
we're
I just want you to know you're
and for those and, like, calls.
And that gets no coverage, except for on, on Air America, let's say. Whereas had Bernie, you know, called into Chapo and said, listen, guys, I'm sorry, I should not have had that. Like, That would have been.
I should have used more snake emojis, and I apologize.
front page story, and so there's more. Liability. There's a greater liability involved in that for these candidates,
right?
Than there is on the right.
And it becomes a Bernie Sanders, you know, he says something 4 months later and it's connected to Bernie Sanders. But with that being said, I also think that we are the vehicles for the message for the movement. The movement has not known what to do in the last few months. We're like, wait, where are we going? Even the own Bernie's own campaign had mixed messages. So if you have, you know, your media, your aligned media working with you, if you're going on there and having different types of conversations than you'd have on Rachel Maddow, because when he goes on Rachel Maddow, he's on defense. But when he's on our show, we can loosen up and talk about the future, talk about what's, you know, coming up, how people can organize on the ground. And I think he tried to do that with his own platform. But, you know, I mean, I understand he wanted to get the message out to the campaign through the podcast, but there's more to that. And there, as somebody, you know, Bernie did have his own like channel at one point when, you know, it was in the 80s or something or in the 90s. He should understand more than anybody what it takes to build this infrastructure. I think that Rohan is good at this, by the way.
Our shows. Let's just be blunt. No, I mean, honestly, because it is, no, there is that asymmetry between what, when we're, no, I like the cavalry imagery a lot. Like, you have to feed that. And Rush, I also wonder, like, Rush was such an extreme, like, literally dedicating, you know, like, dictating policy. Almost, right? But we remember, I mean, we used to joke about it, like great clips of Trump being on like, well, you know, Bubba, that's a great point. And he would just be on with some like random dude named Bubba in Alabama. And guess what? Bubba's got like 30,000 people that not only will vote a certain way, but they'll deliver the message, they'll cultivate in their communities. You have to feed that.
You know,
and it's crazy not to.
Okay. As much as I like that idea, because it would probably benefit me personally, I just don't see. Oh my God, stop it! Sorry, my cat's scratching the chair. Fun working from home. I just don't know that alternative media has the potential to become as influential and wide-reaching as corporate media. It's a behemoth in this country. Maybe. Yeah. If we're talking about a decades-long project, you know, it's obviously important. But I think we might get more bang for our buck trying to spread the message, trying to build power in other ways, because most people are not radicalized by listening to a podcast. I'm weird. I'm weird that I got radicalized by hearing ideas, although, you know, experiences as well played a role. Most people get radicalized by engaging in struggle in their own lives. And that's why it's the most important thing right now for the organized left, the socialist left, to be involving itself in every single working class struggle with and as the working class, to try to regrow that bond, bridge the gap between the organized left and the wider working class that's become such a big gulf in the past few decades. And I think that's the only way that political consciousness is really going to spread.
I would also say that I don't think that it works the same on the left as it does on the right. I'm speaking broadly in terms of the value of having politicians on, because, I mean, you can ask Amy Goodman, really. Yeah. I mean, you know, as an example, I mean, the fact is that, it helped Marin to have Barack Obama on the program, but he didn't do anything with it from a political perspective. It certainly built his profile. It helped his business, but Amy Goodman, when she had Bill Clinton on and put the screws on him, basically it was over. At that point.
Well, you know how that interview happened, right, Sam?
What's that?
You know how that happened, though, right?
It was, I think it was more or less a fluke on some
level. Yeah, no, that wasn't a booked interview. I mean, this is a completely different time. He was literally calling random local New York stations to get out the vote for Gore and Clinton, his wife, in 2000. Just happened to call WBAI, and to her credit,
She took advantage.
She used it to just. But that was a very different dynamic.
No, but I'm saying, now, but my point is this: is that like if you're going to have politicians on these shows, and they can either go at them, or not. But you're going to idea that these politicians can go on these shows, raise the profile of the shows, but also then not have it have a liability and be in the same sort of like give them the same value on the right. I just don't think that analogy works in the same way. Mm-hmm. I just
They give a pass to the right.
Yeah, of course. And we all know that. I mean, yeah.
But definitely. I'm saying, but that's why it works for them because it's the same type of circle jerk that you see with like Sam Harris comes on to, Shapiro's show and Rubin's show. And it's just a circle jerk. And unless you do the circle jerk, it is not going to have the same effect and it's not going to be sustainable. But the circle jerk sort of undercuts the notion of independence.
With that being said, I mean, it is interesting that there isn't more recognition of, I mean, I think some people, I think Ro Khanna has been extremely good at this. You know, he called into my SiriusXM show 2.5 years ago and we had a vocal debate because I forgot what issue we disagreed on Twitter. It was before he became this, you know, well-known leftist. But he goes on all the left media and he recognizes that it's important to have those relationships. But for the most part, I mean, it is important that our base shows up because out of all the bases in the electorate, it's the left younger base that does not have the history of showing up to every election versus the Republican base, which watches these shows, which listens to these radio shows, which almost always show up. And yet they still give them the attention that they demand. Partly because I think that they just understand power a little bit more in the Republican institutions.
Because those radio people, like, they actually wield power.
Right.
I mean, for all we can say about the whatever, you know, we can have 60, 70,000 people watch this video today and a couple of 10,000 more watch it on or listen to it or stream it other places and whatnot. But that's nothing compared to what Mark Levin can mobilize, what Laura Ingraham can mobilize on radio. I mean, or Limbaugh. I mean,
I want to push back just a little bit on that because, you know, in 2017, if there hadn't been, frankly, a TYT, you know, the only coverage of the IDC in New York was through TYT for like 6 months and it brought activists involved. I mean, I can't tell you, I still get messages from people and AOC did not get any money until TYT and Ryan Grimm reported on AOC and then her video went viral.
I'm not saying that it has no power, but I'm saying that like in 2005, when George Bush tried to push immigration reform, it was radio hosts around the country, maybe a half dozen of them, who were able to mobilize millions of people. Yes, there's no doubt that you can... we can get some money to candidates. We can get a couple hundred volunteers to go to certain areas. If we, you know, a concerted effort, certainly TYT is, you know, has that ability because they have such an audience, but the scale is radically different.
Yeah.
I mean, in California, right-wing talk radio got Gray Davis, it did recalls. I mean, we don't have that type of media power, and it's not going to happen until the technology radically changes and the structures of it change.
But is that because they're older? I mean, their listeners are prime voters. Our listeners are not prime voters.
Well, but our listeners, we still don't have those numbers. I mean, you know, we just don't have those numbers. First of all, we also live in a different media age where the media is far more fractured than it was even 10, 15 years ago.
But in some respects, though, I think that last point's really big. I don't know if that type of scale is ever going to be replicated.
Right.
I think we have to really get used to being in a radically, like, I think even mass cultural products that everybody tunes into, like the NFL, are dissipating, let alone in like political talk. But I also think, you know, the only way of building some scale is building scale. And there's even just like a basic, you know, I think, I think even the points we just made, like with AOC or the IDC, like there is a certain just political reciprocity dynamic as well. Like mm-hmm. you should give energy back to those that gave you energy, and it will continue to help and be mutually beneficial. It's not that hard to figure out, and it shouldn't be an exception on the left. And of course, there's no contradiction between that and the broader stuff that Jamie's talking about. But I think the idea of the whole market being fragmented is probably a whole other and maybe even more relevant conversation, because I don't think anything's going to come to scale like that.
Let's take some calls. I don't know if we're going to get to some of these video clips that I want to talk to about, but maybe we will. I mean, because Trump was in rare form yesterday, and also, I mean, tough day to slam Joe Biden for a lack of leadership, but this was pretty egregious in my mind. But let's go to the phones. Calling from a 608 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hi, Sam. This is Tom from Monona, Wisconsin.
Tom, welcome to the program.
Could you say that again? You sound like you're talking underwater to me.
I do.
He is underwater.
Tom, are you there?
Nope. But I'll just make a quick comment, and that's all I have. And I beg your all your pardons. I'm a little bit day behind here, so I'm not up to date on what the discussion was today. And I just wanted to interject something about yesterday with respect to the Wisconsin election. And this is apropos of nothing except to say that when Tony Evers won the governorship election, it was pointed out, unbelievably so, by the likes of Robin Voss, who is the assembly majority leader, that but for Milwaukee County and Dane County, well, he wouldn't have won. And it just goes to show the sort of attitude of, well, yeah, where the population is, people will vote for a Democrat quite often. And somehow that's not legitimate, because I guess we decided that landmass was more important than actual individuals voting. So this is the kind of thing that we're always up against. And I'm sure it relates to the discussion today. It certainly relates to the discussion yesterday. In any case, I appreciate all of the shows you guys do. You're all very good. I learned so much from listening to all of you. I'll get off the phone and let somebody else on. But thank you so much for doing what you do, okay?
Thanks for the call.
Thanks, Stacey.
Let me try and call back in and see what's going on with my system. I may have a little bit of an issue. Let's do...
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report.
Let's play this clip, though, in the meantime, Brendan. We've been talking about, you know, one of the points I wanted to make very early on about Sanders' speech is, or I should say, you know, address, as it were, to the country in terms of him dropping out, was just remember that Elizabeth Warren still has not endorsed Joe Biden. She said he was a really good guy. Bernie Sanders said the same thing. Really good guy. No explicit endorsement. We spoke to Josh Orton, who's a senior policy director and senior advisor, said that when Bernie Sanders endorses him, we'll know that. And whereas I do not remember, I heard criticism from the left that Elizabeth Warren should be endorsing Bernie Sanders. But I don't remember any criticism of, like, she's not endorsing Joe Biden enough. And I don't know if anybody has seen that recently, let me know. But let's play this video from CNN, where apparently not enough by Bernie Sanders.
Today, I congratulate Joe Biden, a very decent man, who I will work with to move our progressive ideas forward.
Is Senator Sanders, in saying goodbye, did acknowledge that Joe Biden had an insurmountable lead, but he didn't say anything nice about Joe Biden. He did not say he'd spoken to him. He did not say he would work with him. He said it was imperative.
Now, wait a second. To be fair, John King rolled that piece of tape 3 minutes before he said this. So there is a, I think the guy who tweeted this out did cut. So there's really 3 minutes. Now, 3 minutes is a long time. You can forget what you've heard sometimes, or maybe you're just not paying attention. But here's John King. He's got a story. He wants to go with it no matter what. Roll it back so that people get this. So that people listen to what Bernie said. 3 minutes later, John King says, I never heard it.
Today, I congratulate Joe Biden, a very decent man, who I will work with to move our progressive ideas forward.
Is Senator Sanders, in saying goodbye, did acknowledge that Joe Biden had an insurmountable lead, but he didn't say anything nice about Joe Biden. He did not say he had spoken to him. He did not say he would work with him. He said it was imperative to beat President Trump, but there was no big embrace of Joe Biden. He said nicer things about Joe Biden back during some of the Democratic debates than he said in saying goodbye.
Oh, my
well, God. Poor John King. He didn't get a chance to listen to the tape that he just ran. Sometimes that happens. Somebody's talking to you here. You're rolling some video, pay attention to it. And then you come out and you make an ass of yourself.
But who cares?
Well,
if that's the thing he leads with. And then, by the way, they all echoed it because I watched it right before I came on in real time. They all echoed the point. They kept going, doubling down. God. That's the most important thing to bring up in this moment. Even if that's the case, they still can't hold back. They can't hold back on shitting a guy when he's down in the middle of a pandemic. I'm sorry, but this is
they're already pivoting clearly to coming up with places to point the blame when sure. Biden loses really badly to Trump. So, I mean, no matter what Bernie had said on that video, it probably wouldn't have been enough for them.
I would also argue that it's not just about placing the blame on Bernie. It is also now there is an instinctual desire by the media to attack the Democratic frontrunner, regardless of what the situation is. So you're going to see a lot more criticism of Biden going forward. And this, I also think, is a way of undercutting Biden, right? By saying that, like, look, this guy's just dropped out and he's basically declared war on Biden. I mean, that's the subtext of what they're saying, that the Democrats are in disarray in that situation.
100%. And I think pretty much has been said. And I also just want to say, too, as a kind of general, like, if you are interested, let's say John King is actually concerned about Donald Trump being defeated and he has some notion of making sure a bunch of voters don't bail on the Democratic nominee, trying to force, like, the most effective means of someone like Bernie is to simply talk about Trump, not to do a fake case for Biden. It is a purely negative case, is the only way you could have a prayer of mobilizing those voters. Is essentially pretending that Biden doesn't exist and talking about ICE.
Joe likes Amtrak too.
I'm serious though. Like, this guy is price gouging during a pandemic.
Yeah.
Children are in concentration camps that he is actually probably making sure that the people who put them there get masks. The economy's imploding. Like, the idea that in addition to the complete non-recognition of reality about Bernie's base and the material conditions of the country and the endless trashing of Bernie, no matter how gracious he is, the idea that Bernie or his surrogates or anybody else is going to do anything for Biden by pretending that it's about Biden and nothing other than a purely negative vote is a fantasy and should be. And the people who actually care about the result of defeating Trump should be the first ones to drop it.
That's what the Democratic voters are saying.
Every poll showed
that 65% of the people going in to cast a ballot were doing it because they want to beat Trump, not because there's an issue set that they agree with the person that they're voting with. That's 65% basically said my number one
electability argument.
My number one
all,
priority.
So
the issue is, and the electability argument is a second order response to, I just want to defeat Trump.
Yeah.
And that's it. And so the idea that one has to say Joe Biden is great to inspire people to vote against Trump, wrong. What Sanders needs to do is to basically say, regardless of what Joe Biden does, Donald Trump is worse, because Donald Trump is worse. I mean, it is self-evident. There are going to be the immiseration that is going to come from the way that he handled this. And we don't even, I mean, I think the thing that, like, you know, hopefully we will hear more of going forward, but I don't know how you even wrap your minds around this, is what does Donald Trump look like in a second term? Yeah. Like, what does Donald Trump look like when it's like the, you know, he's fired, apparently, according to not only has he fired a couple of IGs on the, he fired the slush fund IG now. Yeah. He has fired the IG who was looking at the intelligence community, but apparently he's got a list of like five or six other IGs that he's going to fire. These are the internal watchdogs of our apparatus of our government. He's firing these people now. What he does in a second term, forget about it. And so,
but no one's paying attention now. That's why.
Well, I mean, no one's paying attention now, but you can pay attention in February of 2021. And if he's the president, it doesn't matter.
So stop bitching about what Bernie does or does not say. I mean, I remember the most effective clip, and this is a micro level, right? 2016. I did one of my first clips about how horrible Hillary was and how justified people were on every level, foreign and domestic, to not want to vote for her, and then carefully laying out a case as to why I would Donald still Trump recommend in a right, swing state you vote for Trump. That's it. I mean, you vote for Hillary. That's it. Like this, like,
that's not John far, King's mission. That's not John King's mission. That's
no, it's obviously not John King's mission, but I see it in a lot of, you know, look, Democratic fan accounts. And if they're remotely serious, they need to shut up.
That is what is called is getting into the circle of trust.
Yes.
Right. I am going to meet you where your perspective is, and I'm going to acknowledge that your perspective is legitimate. And now I'm going to explain to you, I'm going to bring in other factors that are going to influence your opinion. They know, those people, like Neera Tanden knows.
Right.
Because she's gone through that type of training. She didn't listen to it.
She funded those trainings.
And she probably paid for those trainings.
But doesn't listen to it.
But she didn't listen to it.
Well, okay, with that all being said, Bernie saying today in his speech that you can still vote for him in the primary because he wants to have delegates at the convention. I'm actually surprised that they didn't go after him on that. And I'm actually a little surprised that he did it and disappointed, honestly, because number one, like, listen, I'm pro reforming the DNC. You all know that. But the reality is that is going to be used as an excuse for blaming the Bernie voters for not turning out for Biden, for not, you know, for sowing more division. It is what Bernie voters are now going to use as their mechanism to hold Biden accountable in whatever way or form, and then threaten a third party run or whatever is being floated right now on the internet again after 2016. But at the end of the day, I don't even think that those delegates, this is different than 2016. In 2016, those delegates had already raised money, bought their hotel rooms, thought there was going to be a floor fight because there actually was a significant case to be made that Bernie Sanders did, Hillary Clinton did not reach the number needed to win the nomination. Of course, that's the same argument today, but, you know, Bernie Sanders is getting out of the election before half of the states have even decided to cast a ballot. So having some sort of divided DNC convention is a ridiculous argument for Bernie Sanders to be making at this point, you know, saying he wants the platform that we know can be ripped up in a second and no one really takes seriously. Right. I just don't think he's doing any service to the movement by putting them in a position now where they can cling to one more piece of hope for Bernie Sanders rather than thinking about what's really on the line right now. And, one more note just on third parties, cut it, guys, cut it. Unless you can take over the legislatures, the Republican legislatures in this country, and, you know, in the next 4 years, get on the ballot in all of these states, the third party is just like your easy way out of being like, I don't want to be involved with the Democrats and take over the Democratic Party because it's just too hard.
I think on local levels, we can rethink that, to be honest. I'm interested
where?
In state and local. Well, they did it in Vermont. Adolf Reed had an interesting effort in South Carolina. Well, look, no, Mickey, I mean, I don't know if that's the answer.
How does that pressure the presidential election?
sure. And quote unquote, taking over the Democratic Party seems like a fool's errand too.
It's so, not though. I mean, listen, I know I'm going to beat the drumbeat on this, but there's like 20 people. There's literally like 20 people setting the rules and we have not exposed them. We haven't put we have to know where our pressure points are. Mm-hmm. We can't just throw our arms up in the air when we're like, oh, it's too hard to read. It's too hard to understand who to go after. That's what we did with the IDC. People woke up and thought, all right, who's holding up the legislature in New York? Oh my God, it's just 8 stupid senators?
You didn't see my latest piece? Oh my God, it's too hard. Throw your hands up. What's wrong with you?
Yeah, let's go start a third, you know, let's get on the ballot in 50 states and all of them have different.
Absolutely. But at the same time, we need to be real that the Democratic Party has not shifted at all significantly in the last several years. And
what does that mean?
Effort is going to be even more difficult.
By what are you measuring that?
What do you mean, what am I measuring that by?
Well, I mean, I'm curious as to what you're measuring that by.
Well, I'm measuring it by the leadership of the party,
but like expressed
the voting base of the party, the policy of the party.
Well, the policies,
power centers of
the policies have changed. I can tell you this. Okay, well, to the extent that the Democrats have had any ability to affect policy over the past 3 years, mm-hmm. Obviously they haven't. They haven't been in a position to do that. But you look at at what's going on in California in terms of Gavin Newsom. He is a Democrat. He is the Democrat who is the governor of the largest state in the country. Right. He has moved to the left. Even Andrew Cuomo, who I loathe, has moved to the left.
Have you read the new Cuomo budget?
Sam? I don't know what.
I have read the new Cuomo budget.
Cuts.
I understand. I understand the Medicaid cuts that he's offering. I understand.
Where has he moved left? His pseudo anti-fracking.
It's all those pseudo things are a move to the left. There is no doubt about it. Okay,
we're getting rid of the IDC. We shouldn't have to fake moving to the left. It should just be like.
I'm not saying the question is not is he sufficiently left. The question is, has there been movement? The reason why he's had to have movement, just the elimination of the IDC is an example of the move to the left. I know in his heart, he doesn't give a shit.
When
he
you
is a piece
look
of garbage.
At the bailout but, package, when you look at, no, because I can't just do it. Look, yes, there's little micro examples. There's different movements. And Newsom is a better governor than I would have expected.
Yes.
Cool. There you go.
It's a progressive state.
I have no problem with that.
Progressive movement in that state.
I
don't
agree,
know. I wouldn't hang my hat on Newsom yet, but I will.
It's just that there is no evidence that the Democratic Party is in the same place.
Nationally, we literally don't even have a functioning centrist opposition party to even do a bailout that is like. It's worse, okay. Arguably, than 2008. There isn't a separate stimulus package like under Obama, which is actually somewhat decent. There's less constraints on a greater amount of money. Right. And I don't see any leadership from Biden, Schumer, or Pelosi.
I agree.
We need
with
to be real about
said,
that.
But we are also 3 weeks into this. You're comparing it to a 1 year period of time in terms of stimulus.
Yes.
And
where theoretically, if we had moved left and also this reflects my generation and the immediacy of needs that I know of people personally. So I can't like,
now, I know people who need things personally. I understand.
They will come,
but it's not a question of,
they will
it is
try
simply,
to
you
have
made
a second.
An assessment, an assertion. That it has not moved to left. And I can tell you that if you take more than
structurally, it has not.
Well, I don't know what structurally means
either.
I mean, in terms of power, leadership,
I'm in between both
of
you. I think what we have to keep in mind here is, okay, there are more positions. We have more progressives, for instance, in Congress. You know, the Progressive Caucus, be that whatever it is right now.
It's far better than it was in the last incarnation.
But they are not.
They don't have power.
They are not using their power effectively. They are not applying to the pressure points, including Bernie Sanders.
Yes.
If Bernie Sanders was more militant in his operation, if his campaign was more militant, I have no doubt we would be in a very, different situation today, and possibly even have the nomination.
I am not disagreeing with anything you're saying. I am disagreeing with the idea that we haven't moved to the left.
So
because Bernie Sanders could not even get booked on a television show 5 years, you know, 5 years ago.
You couldn't talk about campaign finance reform 5 years ago. You can do a lot of things 5 years ago on cable news. But with that being said, they're exercising their power more, knowing that we are a movement that is growing, but not in solidarity. And so that's, I think, what ultimately Michael is saying is that, you know, structurally, we are not more to the left because they're only flexing their muscles more right now.
I understand that ideas have, but it's like you said earlier, Sam, like it's that and a, what I forget what the phrase you use, but sure.
And a quarter. But this is a question of whether or not, but this is in the context of, can you take over the Democratic Party? And there is no doubt that it can be done. There is no doubt that it can be done. Of course,
listen,
it can be done.
Keith Ellison lost by a handful of votes, and it took the second ballot, which they didn't expect to get to, because Barack Obama was making phone calls. That is what you call the establishment losing and really calling in the last minute favors. If we focused, if we realized what it took to get, you know, Tony, whatever his name is, Osorio on the DNC, who's a lobbyist, out. These are people who've never had to answer to anybody and get embarrassed and have conniption fits on Twitter when they're exposed. You know, how many DNC chairs have been canceled, truly canceled, because someone just decided to shine a light on them in the last 4 years?
The left better get a lot
three or
more
four of them
to do it.
We've got to be more strategic, but we as a move, as in the media, also have to realize that this is important stuff we have to cover, and people need to know where to look because they're looking at us. And I mean, we try, I think all of us try on this show, but we have to have a strategy. And that's where I actually put a little bit of the blame on Bernie, because he just has no interest in party politics because he's from Vermont, because, you know, Jeff Weaver is from Virginia. You know, they don't care about the deal making. They don't care about how politics and power work because they haven't really had to operate in that place, and it's not natural to them. But that's not what's going to work for us as a movement. We really have to become more sophisticated. We have to understand what solidarity is. We have to call out organizations that you know, are doing backroom deals and not taking votes. And they have to feel that pressure. It can't just be having a Twitter fight for 24 hours and making it a trend on Twitter. It has to be more than that. We have to exercise our power in real ways.
And we also, in order to do that, have to be real about how limited it is and how high the barriers are. And I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm not saying that there's a better alternative. I'm not a Green Party fantasist, but I also just, look, we don't even have a leadership that has said, we can't go on vacation right now, because people are going to lose their homes and they're dying of a pandemic.
Totally.
Like, this is a fucking disaster. We better be real about it.
Yep.
I mean, I don't think these things are mutually exclusive concepts.
No, they're not mutually exclusive. But I think in a lot of these arguments, it's points of emphasis. But, you know, yeah, look, I any argument about being more strategic and serious about how to acquire and use power, I'm all for.
Let's go to the phones. Calling from a 571 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hello?
571, who's this? Where are you calling from?
Oh, hey, this is Mike from California.
Mike from... Me? Yes, can you hear me?
Okay, I have a little bit of, you know, worry that basically there's, like, reality not being acknowledged here. Like, for example, a ton of people are dying because of pneumonia and unspecified respiratory illness. A ton of people are dying in their homes.
Yep.
Trump's probably going to lose the election because his voters are going to die. And so it's going to be really easy. You know, that could be an eventuality. We could have millions of people die. Mm. And then no one's planning for that. Like, what happens if that happens? Who keeps the lights on?
Well, I mean, I don't think that we're in a position where we're going to have millions of people die. I do think that we're going to be in a position where we could have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people die. I happen to agree with you that I think that the implications of this are going to be such that it's going to make it very, very difficult for Donald Trump to win. And if we were not in this era of coronavirus, I think I would be a lot more concerned about Joe Biden winning. But I think that we are going to be just simply because I don't know that if he's, you know, has the stamina, But I think at this point that, like, literally Joe Biden could pass away and Jill Biden could say, I'm now the nominee. And Trump, I think, has got a serious uphill climb, because I think we are just at the beginning of seeing the implications of this. And so I think, you know, it is, we are, to be honest with you, on some level, we're taking a break from that analysis of this to look at, you know, with the assumption that at one point politics are going to come. But part of what we're talking about now, it seems to me, is what follows this. Maybe not in terms of from the medical perspective, but in terms of how is society going to respond to having this event, which is unprecedented. We have never lost this many jobs within a 2 to 3 week period in the history of this country. And I don't think that this period is, I don't even think we can talk about this period yet, because we're in the middle of it. I think we're going to hit another wave of job losses. I think it's, you know, I would suspect, and tomorrow we're going to get numbers for last week. I think last week is going to be less than it was the week before, but that's still going to bring us to 14 million people. I would imagine now we're probably close to 16 million people lose their jobs. But my guess is that 2 or 3 weeks out from now, or in a month from now, we're going to have the rate of increase of job loss is going to increase for a while. And the question is, how are we going to respond to this as a country? And I think it's intimately tied to what we're talking about now. Because there are these ideas that Sanders will maintain, and you know, and maybe this is maybe the delegates, you know, I don't know if that plays into it or not, but these ideas are floating out there. And the question is like, who's going to be in Joe Biden's ear, as it were? Right. And who's going to be there and have because we don't have much time. I mean, it's one thing to say that, like, and I agree that the stimulus is a shit show. Part of that is it's like structurally, we don't have a mechanism to get money to people. You know, the Rashida Tlaib suggested, you know, cards and yes. Just be able to refill those.
Yes.
And that to me is, as far as I can tell, the best answer. But that's not something that government has ever done before. And I'm not saying that they couldn't do it. I think they could. Quite easily, you could figure out a way of doing it. But the easiest thing for the government to do is give money to the financial system, because it's just like, it's literally the circuits are already there. All we need to do is literally flick a switch.
That being said, I just want people to remember how easily, relatively speaking, in a totally different time, Medicaid was set up, which is pretty ambitious program by that standard. So if we put our intention to it, there's no doubt that there could be a program.
At one point, I think we're going to be in a position where the government is going to have to say, and I hope, you know, and if it's Donald Trump doing it, it's going to be, you know, Bernie Sanders is going to become a very important asset to Joe Biden. But Donald Trump could say, we're going to make everybody over the age of 40 is on Medicaid now.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that could happen. It could very well happen.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, again,
and they Trump need to suspend rent.
I mean,
and the Democrats are standing in the way of that. I mean, it's
they are standing in the way literally
developers.
Of that.
I mean, in New York in particular, it's like you hand out candy to developers, literally in the budget, handing out candy to developers and mortgage relief, which is understandable. But there's no excuse now for saying that there can't be a rent freeze. If the mortgages have been the excuse, where are we? And we really, I don't know. I mean, I'm just at the point, I don't even think a rent strike is going to work, because it would take 3 months before it even factors
in. Wall Street Journal has said that, has reported that over a third of people have not paid their rent.
Yeah.
I don't know how they make that assessment.
It's just like life.
Right, exactly. And
that needs to get framed as a strike.
Yeah, if we could knit that together into an actual organized strike. I've been talking a lot about this on the Antifada and with my DSA comrades, and there's a healthy debate, right? Because normally when you're doing a rent strike, the leverage is that you can pay the rent if you decide to. You're putting the money in escrow. Now, if people literally can't pay, they don't have that leverage. But that calculus has changed, because who else is your landlord going to find to move into your apartment right now? Right.
Exactly. Exactly.
So I do see some possibilities on the horizon.
Yes.
I also disagree that this is necessarily going to hurt Trump's electoral chances. We are living in such insane, hyper-normalized times. Like, his approval rating is the approval ratings of how he's handling the crisis is like 60%. I think a lot of the time in crisis, people want to rally around the leader. They don't always make the connection with policy. And unfortunately, I think Trump, it's going to fit very well into his usual platform of blaming immigrants and blaming quote unquote open borders and liberals for this disease that came from the East.
I mean, his numbers are going down, and I have a feeling that those numbers are going to get worse. I mean, we're starting to see now the epicenter move out of New York. I mean, we're starting to see the start of it. Let's put it that way. Obviously, you know, New York has accounted for nearly half the deaths, if not more, in the country.
I think,
and the rate of increase because of the density, it's obviously going to happen here first. But we, you know, we're going to see this move to those people who are giving a Donald Trump good ratings on responding to this. It's because they're looking around at their immediate experience and they're not seeing this yet.
But we also have a voting system that is completely undefined at this point. And I think all indications show it's going to favor Donald Trump. And with the factors that small, remember?
When they come back from phase four,
yeah,
the first thing that Democrats should be talking about, it's if you ask me, is if we want to talk about power, the first thing they should be talking about is the voting, how we go about voting. Because you can say we're going to get X, Y, or Z in terms of relief right now, but the pressure is on Donald Trump to provide the relief. The one thing that that could easily be skirted by would be how you vote. And any relief that is coming to people in the near term is not going to be there in the long term if Donald Trump wins again.
That's going to go straight to the Supreme Court. I mean, we don't even have a clear definition as Democrats what a favorable vote by mail system is. I mean, there are primaries right now through Matriarch. We're working with several candidates who have, you know, vote by mail. But in some cases, the postage is paid for. Guess what? That favors the establishment. I mean, there's all these factors that we haven't really had a deep enough conversation about. And you have Republicans who are going to fight it at every level because it only, it's a waste of voter suppression.
Talk about this.
Their
let's
voter
talk.
Suppression.
Well, since we've brought it up, here is Donald Trump talking about vote by mail. Let's talk about this. This is number six, where Donald Trump talks about all the different ways that people can cheat through mail-in ballots.
Exactly.
Now, in is it Oregon? They have all mail-in ballot election. Here is Donald Trump, who has been studying this apparently for a long time, just like with medicine.
It was 15 minutes after I put out an endorsement that they said we have to move the election. They didn't want to move the election before that. The other thing they want to do, which is crazy, at the end of the election, they wanted to have 1 week for proxies to come in or mail ballots. Now, mail ballots, they cheat, okay? People cheat. Mail ballots are a very dangerous thing for this country because they're cheaters. They go and collect them. They're fraudulent in many cases. You got to vote. And they should have voter ID, by the way. You want to really do it right. You have voter ID.
All right. So Donald Trump is talking about in Wisconsin, he's saying that they wanted an extra week. In fact, when the Supreme Court overturned the ruling by a circuit court that they could have that extra week and would count the ballots that were sent in, because we have people online, and we can play that video in a minute. We have people online in Wisconsin who were saying, I sent in my ballot 3 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. I sent in a request 3 weeks ago for a, you know, mid-March for an absentee ballot. I never got it. And
right.
So the idea was that all those ballots are sent out, 9,000, 10,000 of them at least. People didn't know there wasn't going to be an election 6 weeks out. They didn't know that, you know, 4 weeks out that you were going to have a situation where we're going to have a pandemic and we can't go vote. And when the Supreme Court said, no, you cannot count ballots that come in after yesterday, they did not reverse the holding by the circuit court that you could announce the election results next week. So in other words, we're not going to know who won Wisconsin because they were not under any type of mandate to count the ballots. That part was remained in the order by the lower court. And the Supreme Court just overturned the fact that you could count in ballots that come in later because of how late the ballots were sent out. That's what Donald Trump's talking about there. He's arguing that mail-in ballots, Donald Trump has just finished arguing that mail-in ballots are easily corruptible and we shouldn't allow them at all because they're corruptible. And then he's asked, hey, wait a second. How do you vote? By someone in the White House press room. This is clip number 6. Unreal. No sound.
I think mail-in
voting. Critical of mail-in voting, mail-in ballots for voting.
I think mail-in voting is horrible.
But you voted by mail in Florida's election last month, didn't you?
Sure, I could vote by mail for that.
How do you reconcile that?
Because I'm allowed to. Well, that's called out of state. You know why I voted? Because I happen to be in the White House and I won't be able to go to Florida and vote.
But let me just say,
well, there's a big difference between somebody that's out of state and does a ballot and everything sealed, certified, and everything else. You see what you have to do with the certifications. And you get thousands and thousands of people sitting in somebody's living room signing ballots all over the place. No, I think that mail-in voting is a terrible thing. I think if you vote, you should go. And even the concept of early voting is not the greatest because a lot of things happen, but it's okay. But you should go and you should vote. I think you should go and you should vote. You look at what they do where they grab thousands of mail-in ballots and they dump it. I'll tell you what, and I don't have to tell you, you can look at the statistics. There's a lot of dishonesty going along with mail-in voting, mail-in ballots.
I think the biggest level of dishonesty we just saw where the president said that there was a lot of problems. I love the idea like, no, I can do it because I'm allowed to do it.
You can play back what I just said.
I want to make it clear that I stand with Donald Trump that, and this may be the first time I ever agree with him, you should only do mail-in ballots if you are allowed to do it. Period. And so otherwise, I don't think if you're not allowed to have a mail-in ballot, then I don't think that they should count. But I think the argument is we should allow people to have mail-in ballots because it works for him. But I'm out of state and the mail knows that because this is going to be the central argument that we're going to hear. He is fully aware that if it's a mail-in ballot situation, he could lose. And they're going to desperately try and stop this. We know that that as generally speaking, as rates of ballots go up, Republicans lose. That has been the sort of the general understanding that people has. And he's very nervous about this happening. And he is basically getting ready for the Democrats to demand this. They better demand it. Because it would be another example of Democrats not ensuring that they get power, that they use their leverage to increase their power down the road.
I heard that Nancy Pelosi is considering delaying the election and giving Trump another 5 years in exchange for an extension of a housing credit tax.
Exactly. That's West very Chester. Possible.
Yeah.
Sounds about right.
I mean, I just want to emphasize, like, I think we just legitimately don't know, obviously, who will win the general election. But like the extent to which it is seriously in question is a profound indictment because every marker should be Trump is out, period.
Let me reiterate. Of course, he can lose. We would have that conversation with. I know what you're saying. The idea that it's even controversial as to a question as to whether he could lose in this environment is a function of this. Let's play this clip of Joe Biden.
Yes,
we played a clip yesterday of Joe Biden, where he said, we got to follow the science about having the election in Wisconsin. And honestly, like, that's, it reminded me of when people would ask, like, a guy like Huckabee, like, do you believe in, in global climate change? Well, I'm not a scientist. I mean, that's, there's no difference between saying we've got to follow the scientists and I'm not a scientist. It's just a way of avoiding the question. And Biden also said, well, we also got to listen to the courts, right? Because I'm going to, as the presumptive nominee, yesterday he wasn't officially the presumptive nominee, today he is. I'm going to just say it's up to the courts. Well, apparently that's not what he really believed. Here is an interview with Chris Cuomo and Joe Biden. Did this come from this morning or last night?
I think it was yesterday.
Last night.
So this is after the election has happened. Watch. He has a different perspective on it.
Do you think you won in Wisconsin tonight? Ordinarily, I'd be hitting you over the head with all these exit polls and crosstabs and things that I know about people all the way down to what they like for lunch. We're not going to have anything until Monday. What's your gut?
No, we're not. Well, my gut is that we shouldn't have had the election in the first place. The in-person election. It should have been all mail ballots in. It should have been moved in the way that five other states have done it. It's the idea didn't have enough poll workers in over 100 and some polling places in Milwaukee.
There was not one piece of information that was new to him,
right,
from 24 hours earlier when he answered that question. He didn't bring up courts. He didn't bring up scientists. He didn't bring up any of that. I mean, seriously?
This is the feckless leadership that is frustrating Democrats right now. I mean, our show, I do a monologue. I did it last night. It's going to be out, I think, tomorrow or today, where I run through the countless times the Democrats have been feckless on things that just should not be debated. Whether it's sending people to the polls in Florida or Arizona and saying, listen to your governors that are Republican. I mean, this is...
nuts.
I mean, those were beyond feckless. That was just,
yeah, you're right.
It is disgusting and unacceptable to tell people to vote in these conditions. And two poll workers, I believe, I mean, this was a couple weeks ago in Florida, got the virus. And I think it's not just, it's feckless, but it's also like the classic thing that, you know, that honestly everybody, I mean, just loathes, which is, okay, Joe, you're going to advocate, basically, you're not going to step in, you're not going to call out this travesty, which was at the end forced through by the Roberts Supreme Court.
Right.
But then you're going to cover your ass a little bit the next day by saying, like, hey, we probably shouldn't.
Right.
You know,
the footage outside of Wisconsin, the footage of people in those lines, desperately trying to maintain the distancing in the rain. I mean, this is the type of stuff, like, we are in a failed state right now.
And by the way, it's only because, I mean, the only reason why Tom Perez and Joe Biden, who are locked up in their messaging, wanted to keep it was because there's the voter suppression aspect in Wisconsin. But it would have been so egregious for them to make the case, you know, this is a case that they're making with Obama and his Eric Holder efforts. I mean, this is really about Eric Holder. At the end of the day, when you pull back the curtain, this is about Eric Holder and his efforts in Wisconsin, which are commendable, but really should have been taken care of, I don't know, by not losing all these state legislatures under the Obama administration. And that's why, you know, Tom Perez finally made this decision and Joe Biden made this decision. But it took an extraordinary amount of political pressure from the inside to get them to this point. And that's what's feckless, is that they can't make a decision based on morals. They have to have communications and committee meetings behind the scenes to see, you know, whether or not it's going to offend a donor or an industry or a lobbyist, or it's going to help one of their cronies.
Well, that's and really I would even go for it. Like, forget, I mean, morals, yes, but like also, what kind of tin ear do you have?
Yeah.
Like, I just like, you know, like put aside morals for a moment. Right. What, what, like, how bad at this do you have to be to not know that, like, we knew a week ago they were going to do five polling places in Milwaukee where they normally have 180. How bad at this do you have to be to not know that if I don't come out against this today, tomorrow I'm going to have to be like, well, I was secretly against it. I mean,
but they rule by committee. That's the, ultimately what I'm saying is, unlike an Andrew Cuomo, who has the political instincts to make decisions on his own and listen to the ground and at least pretend to be progressive by labeling something, you know, student loans for all or whatever the hell he does. They rule by committee. They have to go back and see what does Cap say? What is, Barack Obama going to say? They really do have these conversations behind the scenes before they say, okay, fine.
I'm going to say this fantastic Andrew Sullivan piece.
I just want to say, you know, Joe said it was his gut that told him. The thing that I know about overeating is your gut doesn't know until 30 minutes after it's full that it's full. So
that's right. Chew your food slowly.
All those PB&Js and Fig Newtons are really getting
to sort of reminds
let's look
me.
At, let's look at this clip.
I voted before it before I voted against it.
Let's look at this clip.
He doesn't remember saying that 2 days ago.
Let's look at this clip of Milwaukee voters who are lined up. This one is not even as disturbing because the rain is not pelting down on them. They're still in raincoats, but there are videos of like, and these things are going around the block. Yeah. You had pictures. There's pictures of elderly folks who are literally like a half a mile away from the voting booth in line. Think about this. 180 polling places reduced down to 5 in Milwaukee. Here is Shaquille Brewster from MSNBC having a conversation with voters at Riverside High School in Milwaukee, lined up, and they're just about to get into the door. They've obviously been out there for hours.
I'm really concerned about the people and about our rights and, stuff. Mm-hmm. And the Republicans.
People that can't even walk up to the polls at the state in line for 3 hours. Oh, come on, Vic.
Yeah, now it's important more than ever to vote blue. Because red has put us out here. Stop the postponing of the voting. We have to make sure that voice is heard, regardless of this pandemic. That's the situation we're in.
Why not vote absentee? That's going to be a question I get. Why did you not?
I voted, tried to vote absentee, requested my ballot on the 14th, and never received it.
Wow. Same with you. You requested ballots on March 14th?
They said they put my wrong name on here.
Oh, so you got an absentee ballot.
Yeah, but the name is wrong.
I never got
mine. I'm a senior. They put junior down here.
If there's one thing you want people to know who are watching this, what's your message to them?
Vote.
Well, we're strong.
And tell my son to vote. Yeah.
Say that again.
We're strong. We'll get through this. There's hardship, but it's important to make your voice heard. You might feel like one person, but collectively, we're all together.
We're
all helping each other. It's going to be okay.
Just to put a cap on this. The idea that the Republicans in Wisconsin, just a reminder, this came up with John Nichols yesterday. Democrats won 54% of the vote. 54% of the votes cast were for Democrats in the last election for the state legislature. Mm-hmm. Yet, because of gerrymandering, Republicans still control that 66-34. So in a statewide election, you know, come November, if there's actual voting, Republicans may have a problem there, but they're not going to have it in these, Democrats would have to get like 70% of the vote to take over that state legislature. I mean, it's almost an impossibility. It's almost locked in. That's why on Monday, the results of this Supreme Court election in Wisconsin are going to be so huge. Now the court is not in balance, but it's going to make an issue. But here is the Wisconsin Assembly Speaker, who is sent out to try, I guess, to do damage control about how safe it is to vote and how it's not a big deal that Republicans remember now. Evers, he was late to pull the trigger, but he basically said, "I'm shutting down the I want." And he doesn't have the same power that you would have if you were Scott Walker. They stripped him of a lot of power. Mm-hmm. But they went in. He went in. He said, "I want to propose legislation that we punt the election." Republicans kept in session for 17 minutes, and then they ended it. Didn't happen. Then he ordered the election changed. It was overturned by the courts, by the state Supreme Court. And then the extension on absentee ballots, which would have helped some of those people theoretically in line, was also nixed by this, by the federal Supreme Court. Here is Wisconsin Assembly Speaker Robin Voss from Racine County out explaining to people why it's perfectly safe. Take a good look at this and see if you see any cues that might suggest that it's not perfectly safe to go out and vote.
What do you have to say for some of the voters who are concerned about being disenfranchised because they requested the ballot as of Friday but still haven't gotten it and they're afraid to leave their houses?
Well, the best thing about it is, number one, you have the ability to request from your clerk an email ballot. You can fill it out and send it back in. That's what the Elections Board decided yesterday, the Wisconsin Elections Commission. So that's one option for folks. The other one is you can come to a polling place and do it safely. You have the ability to do curbside voting just like they're doing here, even if it's in a different municipality without drive-up voting. You can request that the person come out. They'll deliver you a ballot. They'll check your ID. You are incredibly safe to go out. So I think that's why people have to use their own best judgment. They have to make sure that if they're compromised in any way or worry about the safety of their family, that they do it really smartly. But I look at what's happening here today, and it really makes me proud that the people who run our elections are doing it professionally, but they're also doing it in a way that makes people as safe as they possibly can be, just as safe as they would be when they go out of their house to get groceries or anything else that they need to live their daily life.
Can you?
This mother effer is in a hazmat suit. And I will tell you this, they don't have drive up ballots in Milwaukee.
Right.
They have it in the suburbs where they know that their voters are. And this guy is dressed as if he's about to perform, you know, brain surgery. He's got so much protective gear on that's not available to the public. And frankly, it's highly irresponsible that you wasted that gear on that MF as opposed to somebody who needs it, who's actually going in and dealing with patients. But they, I mean, like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me?
Yeah, this is driving me to vape. I'm sorry to be vaping on the stream, but this guy makes me new choice.
PSA, they just released some sort of statistics on vaping, just as a side note. It affects your lungs, and they're seeing that a lot of people who are young that are being hit by this, they're attributing some of it to the vaping. So just PSA, cut down on vaping, guys.
My mom definitely told me that already. And I was like,
perfectly safe. Perfectly safe. Don't worry about a thing. It's perfectly safe.
Like, I know that it's not good for me.
Sam,
I'm not doing it because I think it's healthy.
But you know, have your lung scar, Jamie. We need you.
I'm a little stressed out right now. Might not be the best time to quit a thing.
Do what we're all doing. Eat.
But I am trying to cut down and eat more.
That is so, so, so disgusting.
Like, does this guy not realize what he's wearing? Like, I mean,
he's wearing a fucking hazmat suit. I'm sorry. I know I shouldn't swear for the stream, but that is like, I mean,
wait, we're not allowed to swear.
Terms like banality of evil need to make a comeback as actual terms that mean something.
This is a guy getting on a spaceship as Earth is burning, saying everything's fine. You'll be all right.
And contrast it with the people before who are a hell of a lot better than the leaders of their party, who are out saying like, oh, you know, we need to do this because, and they're correct. The Roberts Court, John Roberts, great, great, great devotee of the law, not a partisan hack at all, not someone who's dedicated basically the entirety of his career, essentially just rolling back the Voting Rights Act and other major civil rights legislation. Yeah, no, he's great. And then we have this, the guy in a hazmat suit. Whatever. It's grotesque. It's every adjective I could throw at it. But like, I don't know. I guess it's puncturing through a certain, like, you just have an absorption level where you expect this stuff. You're not surprised by it. Of course, of course, of course, of course. And then you see something like that, the literal visual of this guy saying, hey, no problem.
You'll contrast it
with those people. The whole time you're watching those people, you're thinking to myself, oh my God, make sure to not follow your natural impulses while you're chatting with other people. Keep your distance.
Right.
They're risking their lives to vote.
Right.
to vote.
Right, what's that book by Astra Taylor? Sorry. Democracy may not exist, but we'll miss it when it's gone.
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely right. Feeling that vibe right now.
All right. I'm sorry. I just want to do this one last video before we go, because I know, Jamie, you've got to jump to your thing, and we'll talk about that in a second. I'm trying to find, I don't know if I have the clip, but I just want to get this. I just want to amplify this clip. We'll talk about it more in the coming days. But there was a video that that Josh Marshall at Talking Points Memo found online. I mean, he didn't find it, but I mean, it was online. There's a doctor from, I think he's from NYU ICU. Do we have that video, Brendan? Yeah, just play the shorter one, I guess. There is also reporting from Stat News that I have seen, and I'm trying to, I can't quite find that piece of paper, but I want to at least get this out there, because I know that we have people who are doctors, who are working on caring for people, and if we can in any way help this. This is this Stat News. Let me just read this. There are some, this is all anecdotal. These are all just reports from some frontline doctors. But they are suggesting that critical care physicians suspect that blood levels of oxygen, which for decades have driven decisions about breathing support for patients with pneumonia and acute respiratory distress, or I think they call it ARS, acute respiratory syndrome, might be misleading them about how to care for those with COVID-19. In particular, more and more are concerned about the use of intubation and mechanical ventilators. They argue that more patients could receive simpler, non-invasive respiratory support, such as the breathing mask used in sleep apnea, at least to start with, and maybe for the duration of the illness. I'm not going to pretend to even understand this stuff. But there are enough reports, and you know, I trust Josh Marshall's sort of sense of this, that there are some frontline doctors who are saying that what they're treating looks like pneumonia, but does not respond like pneumonia. In pneumonia, your lungs become weak, and they don't have the ability to basically go in and out, and or they've become filled with fluids. And they don't have the ability to sort of pump air in. This doctor, and apparently some others, enough so that this Stat News, which apparently is a credible news, you know, medical news organization, some of these people are suggesting that the protocols in which they use ventilators, where it forces in an air in and out and forces the lungs to do the job, should be rejiggered in some way to just simply provide more oxygen, because the oxygen levels are going down. And this guy doesn't seem to have the answers, but he is suggesting that, and I guess within the context of the medical field, this is controversial and iconoclastic in some way. But if there are doctors out there or people who are working with frontline COVID-19 patients who may be experiencing this, I just want to make the opportunity so that they can connect with this stuff. It's just a way of amplifying it. Let's play this video. Who is the name of the doctor, Brendan? And just let's put up also the his YouTube page so that people can go look. He's done a couple of these videos.
Yeah, his name's Dr. Cameron Kyle Sedell.
Yeah, Cameron Kyle Sedell. And can you show at least his YouTube handle in the video so that people can go and check out more from him?
I can try. There's all kinds of like COVID information that's blocking it, but I'll do my best.
Okay.
Hi, this is Dr. Cameron Kyle Seidel, ER and critical care doctor from New York City. Right now I'm rushing into work. I'm rushing like every hospital in this city is rushing. Our hospital is in an unimaginable condition. We are working extremely hard under extremely stressed conditions. We're stressed not only over concern of our own health, but because we are watching people dying of a disease we do not understand, of a disease we have never seen before. And then we're going home to our families. We live with our kids, our parents, our grandparents. Right now, it is as if the train is slamming down the track at an extremely high velocity under extremely stressed conditions. But we don't know where we're going. We are putting breathing tubes in people and putting them on ventilators and dialing up the pressure to open their lungs. I've talked to doctors all around the country, and it's becoming increasingly clear that the pressure we are providing may be hurting their lungs, that it is highly likely that the high pressures we are using are damaging the lungs of the patients we are putting the breathing tubes in. It's not our fault. We didn't know. This is how we treat ARDS. This is how we've treated it for the last 20 years. 2 days ago, the Italians came out with a letter stating the same thing, that we are running the ventilators in the wrong way. Right now, the news is saying that 100,000 to 250,000 people in this country may die. That means 100,000 to 250,000 people may be put on a ventilator that is programmed wrong. We can change those protocols. We need to change those protocols. COVID-positive patients need oxygen. They do not need pressure. They will need ventilators, but they must be programmed differently. The protocols in this country, in every small, big, medium-sized hospital in this country, must change. They can change. The time for us to change them is rapidly diminishing, but we do have time, but that time is now. We have to change the protocols. Please spread the message. Thank you.
All right. And there's a couple of videos like that that are on there. Like I say, there's a piece in Stat News as of today. Ventilators are overused for COVID-19 patients, doctors say. There's going to be more reporting on this, I imagine. But I'm just putting it out there. Josh Marshall has, at the very least, you know, done some reporting on this guy. And he is, in fact, who he says he is. So, And I don't know. I can't assess the credibility of this at all. We're putting it out there in the off chance that some doctors, nurses who are working with these patients say, hey, wait a second, that comports with my experience too. And maybe they connect, or maybe they start to look at this. And that's why we're doing it. So
I think Cuomo said today in his press conference that there was some sort of... you know, you're more likely to die if you're being hooked up to a ventilator. I don't know if it's because you're in a worse condition or.
It's not necessarily. We don't know. The one thing I do know is that we don't know if that there. We know the percentage of people who are on ventilators who survive is small,
right.
Relatively speaking. Right. But we don't know. This doctor is suggesting that at the very least, the way that the ventilators are operating.
Right.
Is unhelpful. It's possible it's also doing more harm than good, but there's just simply, they have not seen something like this.
What Cuomo said was, Cuomo said is, hey, get my brother more ventilation because I was Ma's favorite.
I was Mom's favorite.
Let's do that for 2 hours.
Yes.
All right. Well, listen, but that's why that video's out there. So, you know, that I don't want to be, I'm not giving medical advice. I just want to make that clear. It's just a way for,
has Jill Biden weighed in on this?
Yes. Thank you.
In his gut.
Surgeon General, Dr. Jill Biden needs to weigh in on this, please.
So we got to jump off. Jamie, I know you're going to jump off. Why don't you tell people what's going on?
So the Antifada recently started a Twitch stream and we're going to be streaming. Starting, actually, it's already started. I'm going to get on as soon as I'm done with the blogs and the post show work. Sean's already streaming. Hopefully, he's not talking about anything too important yet, but we're going to do a post mortem on the Bernie Sanders campaign with the help of our friends, Dickophrenic and Post Cyborg, the Leftcom Line Goes Down Twitter guys who have been doing the Line Goes Down series with Sean. So, well, there's probably going to be a lot of political economy. We're going to talk about some more of the themes that I touched on today. Should be good. Also, we have a new episode out today. It's a crossover with some of the very funny people from Trash Future, which is a very good podcast out of the UK.
Nomi, what's happening with the Nomi Key show?
We have a new episode coming out, I think, tomorrow. And Michael Brooks is on it. You may know him from the Michael Brooks show from here. He's got a book. I don't know where he found the time to write a book, but he's got a very, very interesting book that just came out.
Are you going on tour?
Yeah, he's doing a tour. I literally just texted him to see if he wanted to.
That'd be hilarious to like Joe Biden, like a zero bookstore. It's like, no, we still got to do signings. Still got to come out.
And then you could come out the next day and say like, you know, in my gut,
you know, in my gut, I don't think we should have met at the commune. You know, in my gut, we shouldn't have done that college lecture.
But you can go to patreon.com/TheNomiKeyShow. We also have an unfiltered version of our interview because we tried it the day before and my microphone somehow cut out. And so now we've got a lot of Michael Brooks content, just what you need.
It was a lot of fun. Nomiki, I'm really surprised you want to release that publicly considering some of the things you said. On last night on the Michael Brooks Show, we went in depth on the kind of macro scale of the crisis with Richard Wolff. We talked with Chris Smalls, who's organizing these Amazon strikes. He's an amazing human being. I think this is exactly where really we need great. To be focusing our energy. Post game involving Trinidad and Tobago and others trying to resist. I mean, the United States is stationing a warship in the Caribbean Ocean, not only with regards to threatening Venezuela, but also Caribbean oil production. We're just doing a lot more content in general. Patreon.com/TMBS. I'm going to be hopping on a live stream soon. And I'll just say also real quick, there's my book. And this Saturday, new show I'm co-hosting with Anna Kasparian for the Jacobins YouTube channel. And you can check that out.
Hey.
That's a new project. So thanks, everybody. Stay safe. Stay healthy.
Did I forget to say my Twitch URL? I feel like I did.
Yeah.
What is it?
Still learning. twitch.tv/TheAntifada.
All right. That is what I would have anticipated. Matt.
Literary Hangover, folks, check it out. We did Afro Ben's The Widow Ranter, which is a play about Bacon's Rebellion only 12 years after the fact. So check that out, folks.
All right, folks, don't forget you can become a member of this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. If you're someone who doesn't have the financial resources, you're worried about your job and want the show, just email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Give us a little bit of time and we will definitely get to it. I am taking going on my Passover retreat, but fortunately it times nicely with Michael's Thursday. So I will be back on Friday. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Those folks are still shipping coffee out from Wisconsin. And check it out. You'll enjoy it. And we will see you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess somewhere the choice was made for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you?